Today's episode of Shockwaves is sponsored by Diabolik DVD, featuring demented discs from all over the world. Check them out at www.diabolikdvd.com. They're the number one source for horror, cult, and strange films from around the world. If you're looking for rare, unique, and strange films, then you need to head on over to Diabolik DVD. Right now at Diabolik, we have from Grindhouse Releasing, which is always a blessing. They have Umberto Lenzi's The Tough Ones, which looks really badass, and I've never heard of it.
It's amazing.
Oh, cool. You've seen it? I haven't seen this one yet. They have the all-new titles from Vinegar Syndrome, including Play Dead, Hellmaster, which has a bonkers cover, and I don't know what it's going to be about, and Night Owl. And they also have the latest release from Scream Factory, including the amazing Universal Horror Box Set, Galaxy of Terror, Humanoids of the Deep, and The Entity. So for all your horror and cult cinema needs, head on over to www.diabolikdvd.com or find them on Facebook.
This episode is also brought to you by Fright Rags. Fright Rags is the number one source for horror t-shirts. With specially curated collections created by renowned horror artists, they offer the best art and the best quality anywhere. Brand new this week, Fright Rags is celebrating the 20th anniversary of the Blair Witch Project with 5 new shirts, a baseball tee, socks, and 2 enamel pins. Relive your childhood summers with their colorful retro-style shirts, popular reprints for Jaws and E.T. And our Shockwaves listeners can save 10% now at checkout by entering code WAVES10. Again, that's WAVES10. Save 10% off at checkout.
This episode is also brought to you by Vinegar Syndrome. Coming this month from one of America's top purveyors of sleaze, Vinegar Syndrome is Douglas Slutch's Michigan-lensed and John Saxon starring creature feature Hellmaster. Hits Blu-ray in a new cinematographer-approved 4K restoration, which also presents the film in its never-on-home-video original theatrical version. Peter Whiteman's Satanic Dog Sleeper Play Dead, starring Yvonne DiCarlo, also hits Blu-ray, freshly restored and featuring a first-time interview with its nearly 100-year-old director. Plus, 2 slices of smut in the form of Roger Last House on the Dead End Street, Watkins' The Pink Ladies, uncut for the first time since the early 80s, and Ron Sullivan's Mascara, which was produced, shot, and edited by New York queen of exploitation cinema, Roberta Finlay. Be sure to drop on by the Vinegar Syndrome table if you're planning to head to Indianapolis Day of the Dead, Crypticon Kansas City, Fantasia Genre Film Festival in Montreal, and also remember to check out vinegarsyndrome.com for sales specials and just about all of your exploitation cinema needs. All right, and welcome to episode 152 of Shockwaves. I'm one of your hosts, Rob Galuzzo. Holy shit, the whole team's at the table. Elric Kane.
But it's the last time ever.
Not the last time.
Oh, we don't?
No.
Did Elric just curse us?
Fuck.
This is not the final chapter. This is not Shockwaves goes to hell.
Shockwaves lives next time?
No, right. Shockwaves lives. Ryan Turk's here. What's
Shockwaves
up?
X. Yeah. We're going to space.
Shockwaves X.
So it did bolster our ratings last time we ended our show became blown out. No, when we were like, and then that bolstered the,
it was our biggest spike.
The biggest episode ever.
The threat.
Hey, I'm here too.
Rebecca McKendry's here as well. The whole team is here. Exciting.
Mm-hmm. We got a great guest tonight.
We do.
Ernie.
I'll tease him now.
Ernie's here.
Ernie.
I'll tease him now because all the preamble just kind of gets in the way of a great interview. But we've got the writer of It, Chapter 1 and Chapter 2, and the writer-director of Annabelle Comes Home, Mr. Gary Dillman.
Writer of all Annabelles.
All Annabelles.
Yeah. That's true.
Uh-huh. Everyone.
Yeah, he's kind of James Wan's go-to guy.
I got questions.
But the great thing is he was also the writer of Blood Monkey.
That's true.
From 2007.
Oh. Yeah. Yeah.
Did he know what Shockwaves was, or did you have to educate him when you invited him? Oh, he knew. All right.
People know sometimes.
Well, I know sometimes.
Do you know Blood Monkey?
I don't know Blood Monkey.
See?
You should have.
I should have done my research. It just shows I'm dragon, man.
Wow.
But we all got a lot of stuff to talk about.
Oh, my God.
Oh, yeah.
Too much. Ryan, Child's Play, are we ready?
Oh, shit. Are we doing this? I feel like Child's Play was 10 years ago.
I've been holding on for dear life for weeks.
Well,
I just need to know your thoughts. Are we on the same page here or not?
Yeah, listen, here's my Insta thoughts.
Hashtag
here's your IG story Insta thoughts.
My Insta thoughts. A lot of fun to watch. really puzzled by some of the creative choices they made. Clever at some moments, but ultimately now 3 weeks after seeing it, kind of
can't remember.
Forgettable.
Are you surprised? Because I was surprised when I first saw his first reaction.
Oh, yeah.
No, I was just surprised by his first reaction, which was like one of the worst things he's ever seen. Hmm. To then all the Shockwaves group members saying, this is a really fun slasher.
Yeah.
So then that's why I was curious to hear you, because you're a slasher guy.
Yeah. Yeah. I know there were some great deaths. I don't know how the Christmas lights still stayed on even after they came off the roof and then were pulled through a weed whacker. I don't know what the logic is behind
that.
But everybody is like sitting there going, Ryan, logic, please. Yeah. Listen, it was a fun viewing, mm-hmm. but after fully digesting it, I'm moved on.
But I think that's child's play. I mean, that's
understandable. No, hell no.
That's
not the original. But what do we expect? There's been a bunch of sequels, and this is a remake. So the idea that we wouldn't move on.
No, but, because if it was a remake that I really enjoyed it, it would be completely memorable, and I'd go, you know what? I can't wait to go see that again.
Favorite modern remake? Evil Dead. It's probably mine. The one that stuck with me most.
The last 8 years, Evil Dead.
Hills Have Eyes. Wait, that's more than 8 years ago.
No, that's
right.
But it's close. But that's a good one, too.
Yeah.
Yeah, Evil Dead.
But I do have to
Evil
say,
Dead
Evil
really
Dead remake is Shockwaves approved, I believe. Yeah. Correct?
My yes. Yes, I think we all love it. Yeah. Because I'm teaching the horror production class this summer. So, like, literally every morning I go in and stare at 35 college students who live horror. Like, mm-hmm. it's their favorite thing in the world. They fucking loved this, the Child Play remake. Oh, yeah. They
speaks
loved
to the youth.
It. Yeah. Yeah. Okay. And I don't think most of them has seen all of the sequels. Like, all of them had seen the first one. But when I was like, okay, well, who's seen Seed of Chucky? Like, one person raised their hand.
Yeah, but I don't think they've seen the original. The sequels are irrelevant.
Part two is awesome.
I just have to say, just like, I just think it's dumb. And it's like, to me, it's like the fact that you have a great property. And you don't, and I don't know, maybe it was a legal thing that you don't use any of it, like any of the mythology or any of the stuff that they built
Might
up.
Be, yeah.
I saw the director say that there were certain kills he couldn't do because mm-hmm. they were in the sequels.
Probably, yeah.
And I'm like, well, that sounds just really problematic in general. Yeah. But, you know, the fact that they don't use Charles E. Ray or any of that.
It was definitely weird just having Chucky as a full-on just like AI entity. And giving him a singular purpose.
That's weird.
Are you serious?
No, I didn't know that.
Oh, yeah.
I mean, it's not spoiler. I'm not worried, but
it's
I'm
not
like,
a spoiler. No, he's an AI robot that imprints on the kid. And, you know, I mean, like, it was like character things that I kind of had issues with. It's like Aubrey Plaza should have been the sister. Like, Aubrey Plaza should have been the older sister, but they had to like address it with a throwaway line where she's like, yeah, I know. I like banged some guy on my 16th birthday. And you're like, that's not good writing. Mm-hmm. Like, that is just, we're addressing the casting issue and we're just going to throw it away with like a piece of.
But it is somebody's truth.
Crude.
Somebody has banged somebody at 16.
Well, and, sure. You
know, that is their truth. They live with that.
Here's the thing. Nothing felt authentic about it. It wasn't like, oh, it's a really important story that we have a young mom. It was just like, oh, we cast our report. We better fix that. Yeah. Just like Andy says at one point, I'm a little too old to have a doll. I think
yeah,
he made me.
You know, yeah,
and you're
sure.
like, yeah, you are, dude. Well, you're too old to have that doll. Yeah.
There was a lot of stuff that there were just like a lot of things that mounted up that didn't feel that didn't feel true to me, even though, you know, I did enjoy seeing the weird Jack Black ish guy in the basement get killed. And
but I mean, like, this sweaty, like, you know,
there was
it was so many cliche. It felt like it was made by people that just checked the boxes of every cliche that's like, this is what horror fans are gonna like. And again, I know this because I came out of a screening with people that worked on it, and they were like, well, what do you expect? It's pretty good for a killer doll movie, right? Yeah. And I'm just like, have you guys even seen any of these movies?
Yeah.
And again, I had a real problem. I don't know why nobody's saying this, and it's not really a spoiler. But he is an AI doll. He learns about killing, literally, because the kids are watching Texas Chainsaw Massacre 2.
Yeah.
That's a weird one to
choose.
It's canon.
And it's also, it's Orion and MGM and all that stuff.
But like, I mean, there's an extended scene where they're watching that movie and laughing. Yeah. And so Chucky, I hate Chucky. He's like, oh, they must find this funny if I take a knife and hurt people and stuff. I'm like, so you're saying that that's, you know what I mean? It's like kind of saying that he became a killer by watching horror movies.
I think that's probably more topical, the reason that they went with that, because there was the news article like a year ago about the robot that learned to be racist from the internet.
Yeah.
Like, they had a robot read the internet to learn to be a robot, and instead it became like blatantly racist.
And it went on to become president.
And I remember that being a big news article. So.
Yeah, I don't know. But anyway.
I will definitely weigh in because I really wanted to watch it. But we had to make – me and Becca were going to see one of them, and we made the choice.
We made it to Annabelle.
We went Annabelle.
Yes.
And I think it was probably the better choice.
Yes.
It is super fun.
Okay, and this isn't just because of the guest.
Yeah.
I really enjoyed that movie.
Oh, no, we had a blast.
This is
I call it my spooky sleepover with Annabelle.
Yeah.
Well, I mean, like, that's exactly what it
and
is.
And I love part two as well. I think part two is the best directed because it's just chops, but this is actually the most fun because this is like just a spook house movie, and I love, like, my favorite part of Halloween, the remake was babysitter stuff, and this goes all in as a babysitter movie. And so the whole film is basically taking place in the house.
Yeah. And it really
and super fun.
For me, it felt like, just because I just rewatched both of the Goosebumps films with my kids, it reminded me a lot of that, where it's like all of these things have been unleashed. Which will you find? Which will you encounter? And which is going to kill you?
No, you definitely sense that they're like, anything they touch could be a franchise in here. And I was like, I'm totally okay with that because I like all the
the ferryman,
the
weird
the monkey.
Werewolf,
I like the monkey,
the
thing.
Monkey, the television that predicts your future. Which will it be?
It definitely felt like a YA Christopher Pike, you know, novel. It was a lot of fun, and what was also surprising is that there is an emotional thread that goes through it that has nothing to do with the main character, but a side character. And you're like, oh, this is her kind of emotional through story. This is great.
I think it's telling that all the characters were likable.
Yeah.
Like, I liked and wanted them all to live, and I'm interested in them. Yeah. And they're not particularly deep, but they're all fun.
Yeah. Yeah.
And it didn't feel as serious to me as a lot of the other films in the Wannaverse. I'm calling it the Wannaverse from now on. Wannaverse pointing it. Whereas, like, Elric and I saw The Nun together, and that was, like, dead serious in, like, a lot of the Conjuring films.
Except for the one guy who's from Czechoslovakia. I have to ask the guest about that line later.
I'm not French.
probably one of the most standout lines of the Wannaverse. You remember the guy that goes, I am not from Czechoslovakia.
I am not from Czechoslovakia.
It felt like he improvised that line. Yeah. We will find out tonight if he improvised that line.
It was like a running gag in the movie. But anyway, like, whereas The Nun felt very serious, and a lot of the Wannaverse films feel very serious, this was really just fun.
No, this is a good time.
It was a lot of jump scares.
And it's also, I think, part of the fun is that it's actually Annabelle's, she's a central component to the why it's happening, but she isn't the main component.
She didn't do anything.
And so it's super fun when it starts just being about lots of different horror icons or new icons.
Well, they maximize the fact that she's a magnet.
Yeah.
Like, which is a really cool idea. I wound up going through an Annabelle binge watch fest because Ciara had never seen the other films. So we started with Sandberg's Annabelle Creation and then went to see Annabelle Comes Home, and then we finished with the very first one. But you know what they keep repeating is, like, Annabelle's a magnet, but they focus on a demon. They're like, Annabelle's a magnet, but they focus on, like, the cult. And this one, they truly maximize and go, Annabelle is a magnet for evil, and here's, like, the true power of it. Mm. And so, all of these things being unleashed was super cool.
Money on which one's the franchise? I'm putting mine on The Killer Bride.
I see The Ferryman.
Ferryman? He was pretty cool.
We both got a lot of screen time, so I could see that. But I'm going to go all in on Weird Monkey with Crashing, Stephen King Monkey with Crashing.
Skeleton Crew Monkey?
I think there's still room to add to that mythos.
Yeah, no, that was a lot of fun. That was a lot of fun.
Yeah, and again, even though it seems like it might be setting up future things, it was like atmospheric from frame one. Like, they're in the house, which is a normal house at this time. It's not even meant to necessarily be haunted, and it still feels like fog's rolling
in. There's fog. They were clearly like round-the-clock hazers going on. No, and the whole thing, it felt
kind of
really
modern
gothic.
It's weird.
Because it had these like gates, like you kept looking at gates and everything, even though that it was this very 70s architecture. I think I even leaned over at one point and I was like, my parents had that kitchen linoleum, which they did, but it still felt really gothic in the shadows and the amount of fog use.
Yeah, good. I mean, seriously, if you like good fun horror, it's probably the most one of the more fun films this year so far, I think.
So, Stranger Things dropped over the 4th of July weekend.
Yes.
Who's seen them all?
Episode.
I'm one more left.
I think I have two more left. Yeah.
I tried to pace it, but
it's a hard one to pace. It feels like one movie. I just watch it all once.
I would have watched them all at once if I ever had that type of time. Like, I never have an evening where I can be like, oh, I'm just going
to that's how I have
like
to digest
7 hours at this.
I digest them, and there's a reason why I feel like they put numerical value at the end of each. You know, it's like Stranger Things 2, Stranger Things 3. It's because they're just 8 hour long feature films.
But you know what? This is the one show that I've done it since season one, because it's funny. I remember when season one aired or dropped, Ryan had a marathon.
Oh, we watched it all.
You watched
one
the
day.
Whole thing in the first day.
Oh, wow.
Stranger Things is the one show that I watch one a day. I just like to savor it over the course of 8 days.
Sure. Nice.
And it feels nice. They do leave really good cliffhangers. And anytime I fight the temptation, and I think it's because I know it's going to be good. Mm-hmm. You know, it's like some shows you're like, oh, when are they going to wrap this up? Is it going to get better? Is this too much? No, 8 episodes is kind of perfect. Mm-hmm. And I've been having a total blast with it.
Yeah.
I mean, I've liked all seasons equally. This one is...
This one's fast and furious. Yeah. And it's got
fun.
Like a lot more creature horror. It's very thing-driven.
Adolescence, which is fun. Like you got some hormones coming
in. It definitely feels like full 80s in effect. Like before we were looking at like the start of the decade and it wasn't... I mean, we were still seeing pop culture references, but man, they are just throwing everything.
Yeah.
And I mean, a lot of them in this one, I have noticed a lot more product placement. God bless. All hail you 7-Eleven when we emerge from the woods and eat Burger King and have Slurpees.
Coke Zero. No, what was it? Coke.
No, New Coke.
New Coke. New Coke. That was a good guess.
But that said, it's been just full throttle 80s, which I'm enjoying. And the soundtrack's been amazing.
Oh, God. Yeah. I mean, I love the production value. I love the kids. I am emotionally invested in this story, you know? And I think this one, I'm especially emotionally invested in Hopper this time around. Yeah. You know?
Oh, interesting.
I really,
there's a lot of backlash for him.
There is.
I don't understand.
It's ridiculous.
Myself. Yeah.
Because of the time period and the kind of character he is, there's something about it I don't.
Yes, it takes place in the 80s.
Yeah, he's a very confused, sad, desperate character.
He's like the anti-Magnum PI.
Yeah. But they
he still dresses the same, yeah.
Well, that's the thing. It's like you're dialing into what a parent was like in the 80s. I mean, like my parents were not perfect. Nobody's parents are perfect. Yeah. Still today, nobody's parents are perfect, but it was definitely a different
I would argue your dad is perfect.
Yeah, my folks are, oh yes. But, you know, it's like this time around, you know, you found... I think with each season you found like the person that you kind of really latch on to and the kind of Hopper Joyce thing that's going on is really phenomenal. And
Joyce is a little more off the rails this season.
Well, I was almost ready to start criticizing the fact that I was like, they don't know how to use Joyce this season. What is going on? She's just doing the exact same thing she did
frantic,
season one. She's
yeah.
finding things. She's just there to find and react. But now, you know, like there's a part in the season where they start utilizing her more. And I was like, okay, finally they found their footing, you know. But I mean, like it's everything that represented the Mid-East. Like when they start with the Russians, I'm like, of course, Russians.
Russians are involved.
Of course. You know, it's just like, okay.
Who's the guy working at the ice cream parlor? What's his name?
Steve.
To me, he's just all-star. Well, him and Ethan Hawke's daughter. And Mia Uma Thurman's daughter. I love her.
Those two are
like the villain of the first season?
Oh, yeah. No, it's one of the best turnarounds in any character.
Yeah.
And I stood in line for 30 minutes last night to have SS Butterscotch at Scoops Ahoy and Burbank.
So the USS Butterscotch flavor is phenomenal.
Everyone said 11's heaven is like the best flavor.
Too much. But I did try to stand in line for Scoops Ahoy in Burbank, and Ciara and I got out and we're like, look at this line around the block. And I was like, it's going to move fast. People eat ice cream fast. And then we hear this woman towards the front and she goes, honey, we've been here for like 90 minutes. And
oh
I was like,
God.
Oh, turn around, abort. Let's go.
It was maybe 30 minutes.
Well, you went
during the day.
Yeah, we went like early
weekend.
Afternoon. So,
but these flavors are available at a regular Baskin-Robbins.
Well,
right?
That's what we did. Yeah, we went to the Baskin-Robbins.
Regular one.
We went to the Baskin-Robbins that's walking distance from our house. And God, some USS Butterscotch. But I think it's a successful season. I've seen a lot of, you know, obviously, you know, when you read too much internet, you start to see people are like, there's too much. It's almost too much 80s. And I've seen
Let's
like a lot
of that.
Young criticism where it's like, I don't understand this. And it's like, okay, I can't fault you for that. I don't know what you want me to say. But I think it's a great season.
It's fun. The only thing I had to explain to my fiance out of country is what New Coke was. She had no concept of New Coke.
Nice.
And also, I love that this show exists in a world where theaters were packed for Day of the Dead.
Mm-hmm. I know that was
right.
So
which
good.
Is fictional, but it's great.
Well, what's great is they almost fetishize the theater going experience because one, they're in Day of the Dead, and people are being caught up in the opening of Day of the Dead,
and that beautiful and
then,
calendar scene.
The calendar scene, and then they go into back. They show you the audience of Back to the Future, and you know you just
that's pretty realistic.
Swells.
How Back to the Future played.
Yeah.
I remember being in the theater for that one.
But what I did notice is they started appropriating different scores this time around. So, you know, the Day of the Dead score is actually used for a scene.
Oh, yeah, part of it, yeah.
I think it's between Steve and Robin. But the scene where Dustin's toys start walking through the house, that's Killer Clown soundtrack.
Really?
So they're they're actually outsourcing for, you know, these scores to actually use them as part, which is what American Horror Story did for its first like 2-3 seasons.
Yeah.
And that ain't cheap.
Nope. Netflix can afford it.
That ain't cheap.
I would say if I had any criticism, it's not of the season, but I feel like after 3, if they, you know, I assume this show keeps going, I would like to see, because I love the character so much and I love them in a Scooby-Doo kind of way, I want to see a new thing that they're investigating. I feel like because all 3 have been so related to that one incident, I would like to see a new incident. To be perfectly honest, I don't know if I need to see the opening and the creature and any of that stuff again personally. That's just where I land on it now.
Well, I wonder where they go with it because it's the evolution of, you know, in this season it's called the Mind Flayer, but it's, you know, it's taken on different incarnations and different motivations. So season 1, it had a singular motivation. Season 2, it's trying something different. Season 3, it's like trying to permeate and get into our world and creating like these. It's very Slither-esque, you know?
Yeah.
It almost feels very Slither-esque.
I thought it was like the Thing meets the Blob.
Yeah.
I felt like that, those vibes.
Yeah, for sure. But I mean, like, it's about the Duffers like kind of zeroing in on what does that thing want now? Or do they just introduce something new?
Yeah.
In fact, I think I read something today that was a quote from them saying, well, we're going to try to expand a little bit more without going into some of the kind of mid-credits thing scene of at the end of the last episode. But stick around through the credits. But they want to expand the world a little bit more. So, and the funny thing is if you're really, really dialed into the show and you love it, call Murray. So Murray gives his number in the show.
Yeah, I've heard.
Call Murray. You're going to get a message and you're going to start going on. You're going to go down an ARG rabbit hole. And Ciara has gone deep. Last night I came home and she was like, honey, I found this website and it's talking about different portals around all over the earth and I'm talking to other people. And I was like, holy crap. She goes, and the calorie count on the USS Butterscotch ice cream label is a code for something else.
Maybe it ties into Under the Silver Lake.
Hey, that would be wonderful.
That's all the codes.
Another movie Ryan did not like.
Fuck you all.
Wait, none of us really gave it a highest praise.
Oh, really?
I liked it.
I liked it, but I definitely wouldn't overrate it.
You like it because Spider-Man's in it.
He's pretty good at it. I mean, you know.
A lot of my students were pissed off at that one because they were all coming off It Follows.
Well, because it's about them.
Yeah.
No, that's part of it. It's unlikable people. He's an ass man, right? Where did we hear that? He's an ass man. I don't even know where that came from, but it was so true.
All right. What else you got?
Okay, I watched The Night Shifter on Shudder. This is a new one. It's a Shudder exclusive, and I'd been hearing a lot of hype about it on Twitter, so I checked it out. This is Brazilian, so it is in Portuguese. And this one, it is Cemetery Man-ish. It's about a guy who can talk to the dead. So he works in a morgue, and so as he is in the morgue, these bodies get wheeled in, and he kind of has like final conversations with them before they get taken off to be buried or wherever or burned. And it's very Cemetery Man-ish in that regard, but that's kind of where it ends. And most of the people that he talks to that get brought in are gangsters and drug dealers in his town in Brazil. And so through that, he learns a lot about the inner workings of the gangsters and drug dealers. So when he finds out that his wife is cheating on him, he kind of manipulates it and goes to one of the gangsters and says that somebody killed somebody else so that they then attack his wife's lover. And then it becomes this huge thing of you have violated the code of the dead. The last thing that someone says, even if they're dead, their last words are sacred and you've lied about it. And so now you're cursed. And that's kind of where the rest of the movie comes out. So it's like Cemetery Man with gangsters and drug dealers. The movie, I can't call it fun. Like some of the things that I was hearing on Twitter was like, oh yeah, it's a fun blast. There is no one in this movie that is in any way likable. And it's a really bleak setting because the majority of it is either in a morgue or in these like slum areas with drug dealers and gangsters.
You sure people weren't tweeting about Night Shift?
No.
Because that's a fun movie. You can have a good time with Night Shift.
So many rats.
Yeah, Michael Keaton. And the Fonz.
But no, this, though I won't call it a fun movie, I did really enjoy it. It definitely has a lot of really good texture to it. And I had it definitely was still an interesting movie.
I just added it to my queue on Shudder via Amazon. And please, if you like this movie, go and review it, because three people reviewed it and two are negative because it's not in English.
And it has
two stars.
That really depresses me that people give things negative reviews.
It's much higher.
This isn't in English, so I can't watch it.
Horror
I think
fans.
Letterboxd has it like at 3.5, which is what I gave it, which is higher. But yeah, it's terrible. Definitely worth checking out. It is in another language, people. I think you can do it.
Yeah, believe it or not, movies get made. Not everyone speaks English in the world.
This one,
maybe they should, Rob.
Yeah, you've seen this one, right, Rob?
I just want to give a shout out to Dennison Romalo, who is the director. He had done a lot of wild shorts, and I remember him coming up through the festival circuit, and he was one of the writers, and he's credited as chief assistant director or chief director on Embodiment of Evil, which was the Coffin Joe reboot.
Yep.
The Return of Coffin Joe.
Oh, because Brazil.
So there's like a lot of weird shit in that. So if you've seen Embodiment of Evil, which is a bevy of weirdness.
It's bonkers.
There's so much stuff in that. You know, you'll get a taste of that here. I like this film. Mm-hmm. I like where it was going. I felt like it kind of overstayed its welcome a little bit.
That's pretty long.
Getting a little too convoluted. But mm-hmm. what I liked is that, you know, this guy was using this gift and using his ability, you know, to kind of serve his own purpose.
Yep.
I mean, you talk about him being unlikable, and it's like, okay. And I liked the twist of, you know, every time he made a decision, he kept getting into deeper and deeper shit.
Yeah, it reminded me of Good Time in that regard.
Yes.
Where it's like one character, we're focused on him. He's kind of schlubby and down on his luck to begin with. And then every decision that he makes throughout
just
the movie
gets worse and worse. And that's what I think was like the kind of motor for me was like, okay, I want to see how bad this gets. Yeah. But it was interesting. It was a very interesting movie, and it's definitely worth checking out on Shudder.
Mm-hmm.
No one ever talked about Etheria, right?
No, we went to Etheria. We were on Etheria like 2 weeks ago.
Yeah, the new winner of the partially Shockwave mm-hmm. sponsored scholarship.
Yeah,
I don't know who the winner was.
Inez. Her name's Inez, and she is phenomenal. And she pitched us a TV concept that I absolutely loved, and I can't wait to see the teaser that she makes with
it. But I will say telling of this was Roger Corman was there, and he's about, I think, 95, 96 now. And he's kind of got a hunch now, and he walks in, and I was just like, you know, it's been a few years since I've seen him talk, and I was just like, it's a moment where you're like, this person's going to – he won't be able to string the sentences in the way. And he had to give the Achievement Award to Gail Ann Hurd, who had come up through him initially. Mm-hmm. And he gets up there, and I just remember like being kind of flabbergasted. He just, no written speech, just gives the most eloquent introduction and speech. It just totally
on. It was like
on.
Game on.
There wasn't a missed beat. This guy, just his brain was, you know, just totally on par. And
it
was a really
tender of stories and sentimentality.
Yeah, but it's really touching the way he like, you know, talked about how she didn't really need us, but she came in, you know, asking what coffee to get. And then, you know, straight away kind of rose up. He knew she was going to rise up pretty quick. And it was really great. And then Gail and Hurd also had a great talk, but it just makes you realize, that's why I love this event. I love having an industry person give an award to another person who was important to them. That was cool. And there's some great shorts. The one that won was particularly great. The Wolf's,
which one?
Wolf's Hair.
Hair Wolf.
It was really good.
Which you can
really
find
good.
On, which if you
it's
have HBO,
HBO
Go, you can check it out.
And it just has one gag. I'll let people know so they know what they're getting in for. It's kind of about gentrification in Brooklyn. And so it's like a black hair salon. And at certain points you see tweaked out, like zombie looking white girls walking by thing going, braids.
Yeah.
and all wanting braids. And I was like, oh, that's pretty fun. But then it just did it in a clever way.
Yeah.
So that was cool. But related to that, the reason I bring it up, they were also playing the feature, another Hulu Into the Dark feature before that. I didn't make on the night, which was a former guest of our show, Gigi Guerrero, Culture Shock. And I caught up on it, Hulu. And this is I think this is up there, like with my other favorite, which is Chelsea's, because it's a solid Twilight Zone, all in vibes, really political. Perfectly now. It's almost unbelievable how well it's timed with the release of 4th of July. But it's, you know, people trying to, characters trying to get across the border who end up being stuck in this, almost this virtual Americana, very Lynchian Blue Velvet America. And, you know, it's kind of somewhere between Black Mirror, because it is tech focused in the concept, and a classic kind of Twilight Zone episode. And I think she did a really good job with it. It's really entertaining. You know, less for me like horror. It is horror you're dealing with, but more ideas based filmmaking. So I thought that was really good. If you haven't checked that one out, because I know sometimes it's hard for people to know which episodes of things like this to jump in if they don't watch everyone. But I definitely put this in the top couple I've seen so far. I assume you knew about it before.
No, Gigi is someone that I've been wanting to work with for a very long time. I met her on the Fantasia film circuit when she had done Luchagor, which was kind of like a weird Texas Chainsaw Massacre meets Luchador.
Oh, yeah, I saw that short.
She's
been in Etheria with a couple shorts.
And when the TV team, you know, reached out to her for this project, it was just like, okay, great, dream come true. And I went to go visit her on set one day, and Barbara was out there.
And we should say that. This is a really fun role for her, because it's very strange. It's very I don't want to put a spoiler on it for exactly what's going on, because it was fun. I didn't actually know anything, so it was fun to just see each beat change, because it really starts in social realism and then takes you to something a little more surreal. So
That's cool.
I have a couple of quick
go
ones.
For it.
Let's see. So I just actually, right before this episode, I came from visiting our old friend and guest Don May Jr. from Synapse Films, and he's currently wrapping up the Restoration of the Living Dead at Manchester Morgue, aka Let Sleeping Corpses Lie. And so I got to see the full thing. Mike Mendez was with me as well, which was kind of fun.
And this was already on Blu-ray, right?
I've
seen it on Blu-ray.
So my first introduction to this movie, this is a, technically, I guess you could say it's Spanish/Italian/English, but it comes from Spanish roots. It's from 1974. My first introduction was back when Anchor Bay was doing these fancy tin cases.
Yes.
And they did, you know, Evil Dead 2 and the Hellraiser movies, Maniac. And this was the one I'd never heard of, Let Sleeping Corpses Lie.
I love it.
So that was the first time I saw it. Yeah. And it's a really cool, zombie movie. From that early era of it.
With environmental themes.
With a big environmental theme, and basically what's causing the whole thing. And then Blue Underground had it for a while, so they put out a Blu-ray of it, and now Synapse has acquired it. And as you know, the level of work and detail they put into things like Suspiria and the Argento stuff, this is equally that. It's just one of the best restorations ever of this movie. But it was actually a real delight for me this time, because I didn't know the context. In other words, when I had seen this, I thought it was a zombie movie, like kind of in that glut of Italian knockoffs in the 80s. And then when he told me today, he's like, no, this is before Dawn of the Dead. This is 1974. And I'm like, holy shit, that's like only several years after the original Night of the Living Dead. It kind of like blew me away, because there's stuff in here that's definitely Day of the Dead, like the way that people get kind of ripped apart from the center of their chest and they're pulling out their organs and stuff.
And it's really brutal. It's a really brutal movie.
It is. It gets pretty nasty and mean-spirited. And I was just like, oh my God, like, I just thought that was invented in Day of the Dead. This is before even Dawn.
Yeah.
And also the coolest little thing is, anytime anyone's infected or a zombie, they always do this great close-up of their eyes. They've got like red eyes, like these red contact lenses in.
Which is a little 28 Days Later. I feel like you talking about it is getting me really excited about revisiting it, because it's something I haven't watched in a while. I had that tin for a long time, and it was one of those like
sight unseen.
It came with a toe tag. Yeah, it was one of those sight unseen. I'm just going to buy it.
Yeah.
Just to further the horror education, and it wound up being one of my favorite zombies ever. I just love that kind of, it found a new way into the zombie subgenre that didn't deal with voodoo. It didn't deal with, you know, something spiritual. It was like, no, this is a pure environmental problem.
Also the politics of it, because again, I didn't realize it was early 70s, and it's kind of like the police giving trouble to the hippie
to
guy.
To the hippie dude,
You know, and you're like, oh.
He rides a scooter, doesn't he?
He rides a little motorcycle. Like a, And in the opening, the main girl character backs up into him. And yes. So basically he's stuck with her for the movie.
He's like a British mod guy. Right?
Yeah, totally. Right, yeah.
So it kind of is an England film.
But no, this is great. Synapse doesn't have a release date, but this is premiering. This 4K one that I watched today is premiering at Fantasia.
Oh, that's cool.
So, which is what, this weekend? The coming weekend. Week? Yeah. So basically by the time you hear this, if you're at Fantasia, definitely make an effort to go see it. It looks great. It's going to come out later this year. And he gave me a few hints of what else he's got in store. And we're going to hear a lot more from Synapse in the offline latter half of this year. Yes, offline. For sure.
Nice.
But yeah, Let Sleeping Corpses Lie, aka The Living Dead of Manchester Morgue.
Love that. I was going to throw in some Heaping Gobs of Love. Rob G.
Oh,
my contest with.
Is this it?
Night Killer.
Oh, man. All right.
Which I bought
saw you guys were watching.
What is Night Killer,
okay,
guys?
So I bought this. Okay, so this is how it went down. I'm at Texas Frightmare.
Yep.
You know, David Gregory is there, and he's like, hey, I got this new thing. And he, like, hands me this Blu-ray, and it's packaged as Texas Chainsaw Massacre 3. And I'm looking at a cover, and it's kind of got, like, a dude with a melted face and a screaming girl on the back. It's got a woman holding a revolver up to a mirror, and it says, I kill you, kill me, or something like that. Then David goes, that's kind of more in line, that back cover. It's more in line with what the movie is.
Is that it?
Oh, that's it.
Okay.
That's it.
1990, Night Killer,
Claudio Fergazzo.
Name that is quality.
Yeah, it absolutely is.
Well, I'm in.
Well, and finished by an uncredited Bruno Mattei.
Exactly.
Oh, now I'm definitely in.
Wait, when Bruno Mattei is finishing the movie, he's the direct call out.
He's brought in to save it.
It is a Claudio Bruno Mattei
piece
of work. How do I describe this movie? It is basically about a woman who... The movie opens at a dance school where this woman is killed by a killer, who wears a kind of melted Freddy Krueger mask. If you said to someone who's never seen a Freddy Krueger movie and you said, okay, this is what Freddy Krueger looks like, and this person has no concept of drawing whatsoever, and you said, draw me Freddy Krueger based on what I tell you. That's what this mask is. So it's really, really terrible. And he's got like a glove that's got long claws on it. And he's prone to just punching people through the chest. Mm. And just that's it. Although when you hear the news reports later in the film, they're like, every victim has been raped and brutally murdered. And you're like, I'm not seeing any rape. He's not raping anybody.
That every moment you're questioning the last, like on the, like,
yes,
it could, there's nothing more entertaining by minutes than this movie.
It's basically, and the concept is this woman gets attacked by this killer after she drops her child off, to two friends of hers. They're going to watch their kid for the weekend. Her husband, the backstory is her husband is a alcoholic cop, who has been thrown off the force. And she gets attacked by this masked killer who calls her. He calls people and he's like, hi, I've been watching you and I'm horny.
Yes.
And then he like starts to describe what's going to happen to her. And then he'll like enter the doorway behind her and he's like, hello. And then he attacks her. She suffers a terrible trauma. But she comes out of it and she doesn't remember anything. She doesn't remember the details.
Pause for 1 second, Ryan.
Yes, please.
Two things I need to say. Number one, now Ryan described it as a knockoff Freddy Krueger mask and a glove. But when I watch the movie, especially the opening scene, I am not aware if it's intended to be a mask or if that's just what the creature's supposed to look like. It's not until halfway through the movie when they say, oh, he wears a mask. I was like, oh.
Well, you do see when he's attacking the dancer,
but I don't
have the thing in the back.
But that's the point.
But you
if that was
supposed
to be.
Knowing it's Claudio and Bruno Mattei, yes, absolutely.
I'm like,
absolutely.
I don't know if that's supposed to be a creature or the mask. Yeah. So that's number one. Number two, the woman who gets the call, who says exactly what he says, hangs up and then immediately, for some reason, takes her top off and looks at herself topless in the mirror.
No. What happened?
Like you do.
I'm going to course correct you because she gets that call and then she gets a call from a mystery man at a bar.
Yes.
And he's like, hey, baby, we haven't talked in a while. She's like, leave me alone. I told you not to call me again. And then he's like, come on. I just want to talk to you. And she's like, no, leave me alone. And she hangs up the phone. And then he gets all pissed off and crushes his glass at the bar. And then we cut back to her and she's kind of wearing this like low slung sweater. And she starts to take the sweater off, revealing her breasts. And she looks in the mirror and she goes, "Gray skies ahead." And that's it.
So, guys, do you recommend the movie?
Well, Becca, yes. We're not even close to done yet.
Becca, I'm not even done yet.
Now, here's the thing. When that moment happens and she says that, this is when I get very uncomfortable because I realize this topless woman looking in the mirror is actually the mom from Silent Night, Deadly Night.
Exactly.
And you're like, oh.
Wait, the original?
Yes.
The one who got raped by the
same. Yeah.
That's the moment when you realize you're like, oh, man. So
she's had a rough career.
And then you realize there are gray skies ahead. And so what happens is now you've got this woman with no memory who's suffering this traumatic experience. And while she's driving to wherever she's driving, this guy pulls up alongside her in a Jeep and he's like drinking and he's like, "Hey, hey." And she's like, "Leave me alone." And he's like, "Hey, you want to have some good times? You want to have some fun?" And she's like, "No, leave me alone." She evades him by taking a hard right and driving down a street, forcing him to back up his Jeep and go down that road. And because the camera lingers on that road for so long, you see that she drove down a dead-end street. The next scene, she is in a bustling metropolis. Somehow she avoided that dead-end street and she wound up on another busy road. Huh. This guy goes and he confronts her in a bathroom somewhere.
Yes.
And she pulls a gun on him and she's like, "What the fuck do you want from me?" He's like, "I told you, I just want a good time." She's like, "Drop trow, throw all your clothes in a fucking bath in the toilet and flush them." And he's like, "What the fuck?" I will stop with the anecdotes with this great moment where she leaves the hotel or wherever she was, running out of the hotel with her gun. And this guy comes out in his like fucking tighty whitey blue underwear, whatever. And the hotel manager goes, "What's wrong?" And he goes, "I just got molested in a little boy's room." And he goes running out. And this movie just operates on a completely different level.
I don't have a plot yet, guys.
Oh, no, wait. So the plot. By the way, this is the first 10 minutes.
This is the first, this is the first 20 minutes of the movie. Yeah. So what you have is you have different threads. You've got a killer who's running around, punching his clawed fist through people for whatever reason. You've got this woman who's trying to unlock who she is while also creating a relationship with the guy from the Jeep.
Yes. Next scene, by the way. Let me just go one more scene further.
Wait,
next
they go out on a
date?
This
is now a director's commentary.
Oh, yeah. The next scene, she goes to a beach to try to commit suicide.
She's got a nice blanket laid out. She's got all her pills laid out.
Taking pills. And the guy that she just stripped and pulled the gun on shows up. And he's like, "No, what are you doing? You must drink seawater to vomit. And get it out of her.
He picks her up and drags her into the ocean and dunks her head into the waves, forcing her to swallow seawater so she could throw it all up.
Wow.
Thus begins their blossoming relationship. Yes. But I won't go further than that because there are twists.
Yeah, and again, that's when I clicked the time meter on my thing. I'm like, 20 minutes in. Okay.
So
I have no idea where this is going.
That's technically like the we get new information at that point.
And it's all about it's a murder mystery. You got to figure out who the killer is. So I watched this by myself because the missus was working. The kid was somewhere else. And I was like, I got Friday to myself. I'm going to watch Night Killer. And I had – it was like Portrait of a Lonely Guy because I was sitting there laughing my ass off, having a beer going, "This is the greatest thing ever. I need to watch this with friends. Where are my friends?" I watched it again that weekend with people. I had a couple of friends visiting and I was like, "Guys, let's watch Night Killer." And they're like, "What the fuck?" They stuck through it. About halfway through, I was like, "Okay, guys, I've pushed you through enough torture. You don't need to watch it again." They're like, "No, we want to see where this goes."
Yeah.
This is batshit insane. So Night Killer is you got to have some friends around, you got to have some booze, and you're going to have a great time with just how incompetent and bizarre every choice is in this movie.
I have never wanted video on our show more than when you were taking off the blouse of the girl 5 seconds ago. You were doing it so tenderly.
Oh, yes. He
took it off his shoulders, then he slowly lowered it sexually, revealing.
And I was showing my chest.
He kind of did show his pecs, and I thought that was kind of beautiful and empathetic of you.
Oh, Night Killer. God bless. It was Severin, right?
The great Severin put this out.
Can I please borrow one of yours and not commit to the purchase price?
It's the most exciting thing to happen to us this whole year is this movie.
Okay. All right.
I don't know how.
Is this our devil's honey for the year?
I don't know about that. That's a whole different ballgame.
That's a different level of weird.
Okay.
I don't know how this was sold as a Texas Chainsaw Massacre movie because I see no similarity.
I want to talk to David about that because I'm like, I genuinely want to know where it was sold. As a Texas Chainsaw Massacre movie.
Well, because I just looked up that title, which is No Abrit Que La Puerta 3, which translates to Do Not Open That Door 3.
Oh, shit.
So were the Texas Chainsaw movies released as Do Not Open That Door?
Yeah.
This is a whole other thing.
Are there Do Not Open That Doors 1 and 2?
2 is really good.
Maybe the Chainsaw movies.
I think it has a lamp in it, a haunted lamp.
I actually watched the Amityville Haunted Lamp movie.
I just teed you up in a beautiful way.
Nice.
I did not know you did
it. Was not as good as the Time one.
Oh, so we don't have a – it's not
no,
a path you're
going
to keep going
to? No, I wrote it down as a passing.
Oh,
like,
and did you watch any of the special features really quick, Rob?
No, I did not. But tell me, is it worth?
It's got Claudio on there talking about how he wanted to make like an art horror movie.
Huh. Yeah, Mike Charles too.
Does it feel arty?
Chef's kiss. That is so good.
So the lamp one's not as good, huh?
I wasn't.
We're going to go between those two movies.
Lamp Amityville was not as good as the Time one. Right. It was lamp recovered from the Amityville house, gets shipped to Florida. California. Like you do. She ships it to her sister in California for some reason, and then it makes people hallucinate. Not the highlight of my
week. Did it have a great...
Hallucinates through its blinding light?
No, it's not even plugged in for most of the time. Like, you look at it and see your dead dad who convinces you to start killing your other family members type thing.
So there's very plug in the lamp.
Wasn't even plugged in for half the movie. Like, it was plugged in for moments, and then the housekeeper who is all knowing is like, there's something evil about this lamp, and then she takes it upstairs to the attic, and then the little girl starts like envisioning her dead father in it and like trying to kill her family.
But did it have a great last line like the other one?
It did not. They didn't say
that was illuminating or
it's about light.
It's about I did love the last line of the other one.
It was not, and I watched another kind of meh movie this week, Gothica. Do you guys even remember Gothica?
Hal Berry.
Ghost.
Directed by...
Wasn't
it by the French director?
It's Dark Castle.
Who did Lahaine?
Yeah.
I remember it was. Like, I was like, oh, what's he going to do? He's such an intense director.
When I was doing... I did the torture porn episode of Nightmare University, and when I was researching kind of the whole history of torture porn and when it kind of came to fruition, it was like right around the same time as all of these art dread horrors were petering out. And it was like one of the last ones to make a shit ton of money was Gothica, which made close to $150 million.
It got my money.
And I was like, I don't even remember this movie. And it was like one of the like the high points of that month in horror was like, well, like, you're never going to beat Gothica. And I was like, I don't even remember this. So I rewatched Gothica. Essentially, this woman, I'm going to reveal the twist here. Fuck it. It's Gothica from 2003.
Is it the twist or is it like the hook?
It's like the twist. So like Halle Berry's husband apparently was a murderer. And in order to – one of his victims' ghost comes back. And in order to get Halle Berry to understand that her husband was a murderer, the ghost possesses her and then frames Halle Berry for the murder. So she ends up in an insane asylum and then has to break out of the insane asylum to go investigate and find where the husband killed her. And I'm like, ghost, couldn't you have just come and said like – your husband's a murderer and my body's over there.
Because
like literally this entire movie is like Halle Berry gets framed for murder, spends half the movie in an insane asylum going, I don't know why I'm fucking here. All while this ghost is showing up like binging her against the wall. Like the ghost is not like beckoning her or writing shit on
ghost
mirrors.
Ghost is not subtle.
No, yeah, it's like mysterious. Beating the shit out of her. And then I'm like, "That what type of messaging is that?" And then at the end, it's like, oh, you were trying to get me to understand that my husband killed you. And Robert Downey Jr.'s in
it. Wasn't
it
the plot of What Lies Beneath?
Kind of, but the ghost didn't beat up Michelle Pfeiffer and frame her for murder.
It's funny because In Dreams is also like that kind of a story, and Set in Assignment also had Robert Downey Jr. It's also a weird horror.
I mean, like, this is the big thing is this has a great plot, great cast. Halle Berry, Robert Jr., Charles Dutton, John Lynch, and Penelope Cruz.
Joel Silver produced.
Yeah, Joel Silver. But that said, like, you know, going in and going, I don't remember Gothica. Had I not written the plot down here, I watched it 2 weeks ago, I would be struggling. struggling to remember exactly what happened.
I kind of lament Dark Castle. I really liked what Dark Castle was going for back then. You know, it kind of made a splash with the House on Haunted Hill was amazing.
Yeah. Well, like 13 Ghosts.
13 Ghosts, I
like
13 is great. Ghosts.
I thought I rewatched Ghost Ship. I talked about that. I kind of was like, I didn't think it held up, but they were starting to make. They were making really interesting decisions, bringing in interesting filmmakers and visions. But then it kind of like, there was a point where it took a turn. It was like The Reaping and Gothica.
I didn't hate The Reaping, but I couldn't tell you what the plot was about. I just remember not
hating it. Who's
the
star? That was a big star, right?
Swank.
Swank. That's right. That was it. And it was like this southern kind of like southern boiled tale with like, locusts and plague and stuff.
It was no like Skeleton Key, I remember.
Yeah, it was not a Skeleton Key. Skeleton Key was great. Yeah. But Gothica.
But I mean, like, it could have been, because it was like Joel Silver and like a lot of the, you know, they were pulling a lot of people and like, it could have been like a Tales from the Crypt-esque mission statement. Mm-hmm. Like, we've got power producers from, you know, Hollywood of yesteryear.
Yeah.
Let's bring in our friends. Let's go tell really interesting macabre stories and it felt like they were going on that path, but it dropped the ball.
And this one was not as fun. Like that was the biggest thing for me. Whereas 13 Ghosts, and I will even put The Haunting into that category a tiny bit. And, House on Haunted Hill and Ghost Ship, they were all fun, like crazy over the top gore fest going, oh my God, I can't believe that just happened. This is like quiet and hard boiled and mostly just about watching Halle Berry in an insane asylum get the shit beat out of her while she tries to convince everybody she's sane.
And that was like, she had just won an Oscar for having the shit beaten out of her right before that movie happened with Monsters Ball. Who knows?
Yeah.
Could be like the trend. But I just remember being, I do remember being over serious. And Matthew Kasovitz was the name, right? The guy did La Haine. Oh, he's the actor in Amelie, actually. He's a really good actor and interesting director.
So super serious. And I guarantee in a week, if you ask me what it's about, I'm going to be like, I don't know, Halle Berry's in it.
Well, what I love about following you guys on Letterboxd now is when I see your viewing habits and I saw Gothica pop up on Becca's thing and I had a moment where I went, no, Becca.
No, and I even, Elric had texted me at some point that night and he was like, what are you doing? And I'm like, I think I've reached my rock bottom. I'm watching Gothica.
Like, why? Last time I probably texted you were watching Gossip. And
no, it was when
Gothica.
I had a cold too, and I was like, I'm on the couch with a summer cold watching Gothica. Yeah. I think this is my rock bottom. But then the savior of the week has been Losey Spookies. Have you guys been watching?
Losey Spookies. Yeah, Losey
Spookies.
I want to see it.
On HBO. It's a lot of fun. I'll just say it's about a group of kids in some really undescribed, like you don't really know where it is. You just know it's a Latin American country who discover that they have a knack for kind of creating these scary scenarios. And so they get hired by people and end up going into business creating these scary scenarios. So like a woman who wants to convince her loved ones that her house is haunted and a priest who wants to convince the world that he can do an exorcism. And it's got Fred Armisen in it and it's fun. And so that's all I will say about that one. But it's been kind of my savior this week. That and Stranger Things.
Yeah, let me give you a quick hook on American Horror Story, American Horror Project, Volume 2. What is that called?
The American Horror Project.
Yeah, so these are my Arrow. I always get really excited about these. And I'll just give you, I won't go too in depth just because we've been here for a while. The first box, I love what they're doing. I wasn't in love with any of the movies in the first box, even though they're all interesting. This Stephen Thorne is one of my biggest influences.
Which came from the sea was fun.
It's a good movie, but it's like not really that interesting horror film. But Stephen Thorne, you know, Nightmare USA, big part of this. I've watched two of them. Dick got the box set, broke them open. Dark August. Highly recommended for people from Vermont or near Vermont, because this is one of the few Vermont in the 70s horror films that I think exists. And it's really about place. What's cool about this, they're always regional horror films. I love that. I love that both the ones I'm going to discuss are both Let's Scare Jessica to Death looking. Okay. You know, that aesthetic that you get. So Dark August is really cool. Pretty interesting movie. Very subtle horror film. It's basically a guy who's moved from the cities to Vermont to kind of get away from it. I think he's recently divorced. He accidentally has, in the backstory, killed a farmer's daughter who's just like run into the middle of the road and he accidentally hit her. That's the backstory of the film. And then unfortunately, the old man puts a curse on him. And it's basically like slowly, they're not Satanists, but they're these people who put a blood curse, a death curse on this guy. And it's slowly encroaching throughout the story. And it's treated very realistically all the way through. Towards the end, he tries to enlist a good witch to help break the spell. And this one, I liked it. It's kind of slow, but it's a solid movie. But then we break out. I haven't seen the third yet, and I'll do a deeper dive when we've seen all three. But The Child, which I'd always seen cover art for, and I think it even was called Demon Child at one point or something like that. This is one of those movies that, like, I'm halfway through this movie. It's all post-dubbed, so it's a little rough. It's this girl who's a babysitter. She's come to become the caregiver for a girl who has lost her mom. She's going through all this fog to get there, and it's really weird, the tone from the start. You're like, what's happening? And she finally gets to this house, and she meets the little girl. The little girl who has a little teddy bear who also talks about her weird friends in the forest. So it's basically got the Pit element,
right? Yeah.
But not comedy, yeah. Like where the Pit's funny and weird. This is treated, but it's almost exactly the same. There's beats that are almost exactly the same kind of shots as the Pit. But then this is one of the movies where it's like half, I watched this last night, and there's moments where I was really tired. And you kind of go out for a second, and it's like a little fractured, and you're like, I don't know if this is very good. So this is like a 2-star movie for about 30 minutes. And you think it's going to be a very straight, dry kind of art house drama in the sense of like the horror. And oh my God, it takes the hardest turn. And if you want to be as surprised as I was, just tune out now. This isn't really – anytime – if you look this movie up, you'll see it in the advertising. I just didn't know. It goes fucking crazy zombie movie, creature feature. They're somewhere between zombies and creatures. She is always talking about – this little girl's talking about her friends in the graveyard who she goes to see every night. And in the last act of this movie, it's like crazy hysteria for the last half of this film where the lead character is just screaming the whole last half. And these freaking things that are actually really cool looking, they kind of have almost weird hand claws, so they're not quite zombies, but the coloring of them, the director does a really good job of not showing you too much, so they actually stay creepy. And this is probably gonna be one of the movies I see in my life that will go from being like, it's a 2-star-ish movie to being one of my favorite like discoveries of the year, because it's just so weird. There isn't one sequence that makes sense as a movie, and not in a just a bonkers way, more like, oh my God, tonally, what is happening in this movie. So this is, I'm going to bet this is the must see.
This is in the box set? How many movies are there? Three?
There's three. The other one's called Dream.
Wait.
The third one, this is volume two, not volume one. The third one is called Something of a Dream, and I haven't seen it yet. So I'll report back. I think Brian wanted me to do adjust the discs of this box set when I'm all done. So I'll go in deeper. But The Child, I did not love any of the films in volume one. I would buy this box for this film and just go in with this, like, what kind of movie this is. I think it's going to kind of blow some people away.
Yeah.
But it's also kind of a bizarro mess. And Stephen Thrower in The Exorcist says this is the reason he wanted to do these entire projects is this movie. He's like, this is the film that inspired me for Nightmare USA. It's the kind of regional film. The guy made one movie. Never made another film again. Distributors took all the money. Like, it's just one of those things that get made and the people don't get careers. They don't get, the glitz of movie making, but there's something in it that's just unique. So anyway, it was a nice surprise. Halfway through, if you had asked me, I would have been like, I don't know, man, this one's pretty dry. But The Child. So I've seen two of the three.
Cool.
Let's wrap up before our guest comes in. I went to the New Beverly last night. Listen to Elric's Pure Cinema if you want to know why Quentin picked these specific movies for the month.
Yeah, we didn't talk about
that.
But you should listen to the Quentin Tarantino episode.
Yes, you should. Because this was one that you guys talked about that I was like, ooh, that sounds fun. And it was a double feature. The first film was called Any Gun Can Play, which was a great Western. But really, I was excited for the second feature, Wicked Wicked, which came out in 1973.
In Duovision.
Do you know what Duovision is, Ryan?
Please, educate me.
This is probably the one and only movie that in its entirety is split screen.
The entire film.
The entire movie is split screen. Yeah. And so because of that,
it
came out. It didn't do well at all. And then it never really got released again because, again, there weren't widescreen TVs or anything. So there was no proper way to do this movie. And I'd say 97-98% of it is there's only a couple shots here and there that go to full screen for like effect.
But it also has like a slasher thing. Like I saw the trailer.
No, it's a slasher movie.
And it looked like the mask was cool. So I was I'm curious.
It's basically a giant – it is the same giant hotel complex from Some Like It Hot. That's the thing they have in common.
He did mention that. Yeah.
So it's the same, this giant complex that people live in, and there's a security guy there, and basically three blonde women in a row check in and never check out. Yeah. And so basically they get the security guy to be like, hey, they stiffed their bill. Can you figure out what happened or why or whatever? And you literally find out that there is a member of the staff that's kind of hiding up and living in little crevices of the complex, who will sneak into your room, wear a mask, and knife you to death randomly.
Mask, right?
And I mean, the tone, it's really cool. The tone is bonkers. They do some really interesting things. Like, basically, I mean, now your attention span can handle this, but the idea of like, it's not like every scene is from two angles. So they'll do things like you're talking to the killer now out of on the left, you're getting the killer to talk about his past, like very vaguely. And then on the right, you're seeing his flashback as him as a kid, like it played out. So you're getting almost like two stories on both sides of the screen. Huh. And then there's certain things that, I mean, it wouldn't have played as well if it wasn't with a new Bev audience. Mm-hmm. Like there's some like things from the 70s that are a little not PC right now that just brought the house down. Mm-hmm. And I mean, it's just a really straightforward, great little slasher movie that I'd never even freaking heard of. Our former guest, Bill Neal, was sitting in front of me and he was blown away too. I was like, can you edit in Duovision?
It kind of sucks because I wanted to watch this one too, but I didn't want, we did that episode, but I didn't want to watch it at home because it does feel like you need to see it on
the
screen.
It was pretty incredible and the audience was great. And I think a Warner Archive did a DVD release of it, but that's it. I don't think there's a Blu-ray or anything, although this should be on Blu-ray. This is a great little discovery. So Wicked Wicked from 1973.
Huh. Can I just throw out Party Line, which Ulrich talked about many episodes ago?
I think I lent it to you, I can't remember, but yes, I did.
I own it, but I haven't seen it.
I bought a sight unseen because you brought Rob, this was you. Leif Garrett.
Yep.
Not for me. and I have to say it informs my future Blind Buy Vinegar Syndrome titles.
It's always a gamble.
Weekend. It's fucking Russian roulette is what it is.
Yes, it is.
because this one was, it just felt like a made for TV movie. It might've been, I don't know, but it's basically about, Leif Garrett and his really warped sister are, running around Hollywood, killing people that are dialing into a party line, and no one is safe. And there's like an element with a teenage girl who calls into the party line. She helps the detectives, and the detective is what's his face from Battlestar Galactica, the original Battlestar, I think. His name is. There was like just no momentum. It was just really dry, and Leif Garrett's just
it's a goofy movie.
It's a fucking goofy movie. So we'll end it on
Party Line.
Well, yes.
I got a short story I never recommend books here, but Paul Tremblay, when he was here, he's got a new book out. Yes. He recommended a short story book. I'm pretty sure it's him, called Greener Pastures, which is by Michael Wehunt, who maybe was a listener. I think that could have been. But there's a short in this that I think I probably shouldn't even tell people now because I would never want to make a found footage film ever. Mm. This is the first story I've ever read where I was like, oh my God, I'd love to make this into a found footage film. But it's super creepy. It is called October Film Haunt Under the House. That's the name of the story. And it is about a website and a group of guys who every year try to pick some kind of haunt or real urban legend to go investigate. And it's written like it's a found footage story. So it's actually in the text. It's like 20 pages. And it goes in this – it's just something about the way he writes this tone of this story. They go to this house and kind of what happens to them. I'll leave it as open as possible. The whole anthology are all really interesting stories. They all are kind of tying horror and nature really well. But this particular story is unnerving and kind of takes what could be a routine found footage and maybe gives it this other bigger almost Lovecraftian spin slightly. Ooh. And I really dug it and I had to borrow it. Yeah, I'll let you borrow it.
Thank
and
you.
then we might have to just quickly get the rights in case they're already gone, because I'm really not the person who usually is interested in found footage, but cool story.
And before we part, we should mention that this Friday tonight,
or if this morning if you're listening to this episode, You can still make it.
Yeah. We are going to be doing a live show at the Don't Panic screening.
At the UCLA Billy Wilder Theater
through AGFA tonight.
With AGFA. So we will be there. Me and Rob have never seen the movie, so we'll be reacting.
It's hilarious. Yeah.
You love the movie. AGFA's, I believe Joe Zimba is going to be there, and he's a really fascinating film curator. So yeah, it should be fun.
Should be fun.
Yeah. So come see Don't Panic. It is definitely kind of a Nightmare on Elm Street knockoff with its own kind of batshit craziness.
I just know the guy wears pajamas because that's what everyone keeps tweeting
through the entire movie.
Okay.
That's all I know. The bulk of the movie.
But we will be there.
Yeah. And great. I'll just do a little quick shout out that I will be on a panel at Comic-Con. So if you're at Comic-Con,
I'm there on Sunday.
I'll be there Saturday.
I'm signing on Sunday.
I will not be signing.
I'm at the Geekscape booth signing on Sunday.
There you go. 7 o'clock, Bold Voices of Horror panel. I'm blanking on the room number, but come check us
out. Is this a horror?
Bold Horror Statements panel?
No, not Bold Horror Statements. Like horror, contemporary horror news or whatever. No, what do we always call them?
State of Horror?
State of Horrors.
No. That's not one of these panels. I did the same thing last year and it was a lot of fun. And this time we've got like Molly Elfman and Amy Nicholson and Akilah Cooper and stuff like that. So, and Gigi Guerrero. So it's going to be a lot of fun. But if you're at Comic-Con, come and say hi.
And I'll be at Rob's and we're just going to sign stuff.
Yeah.
For ourselves. I'll sign for you. You sign for me.
Sure.
But we will be at Midsummer Scream.
When I have no idea when
that's
that is.
August
later in the
3rd.
Month.
Yeah. Okay. But let's bring out our guest.
Yeah, let's get him on.
Diddle, diddle, diddle. All right.
Today's episode of Shockwaves is sponsored by Diabolik DVD, featuring demented discs from all over the world. Check them out at www.diabolikdvd.com. They're the number one source for horror, cult, and strange films from around the world. If you're looking for rare, unique, and strange films, then you need to head on over to Diabolik DVD. Right now at Diabolik, we have from Grindhouse releasing, which is always a blessing. They have Umberto Lenzi's The Tough Ones, which looks really badass, and I've never heard of it.
It's amazing.
Cool, you've seen it? I haven't seen this one yet. They have the all new titles from Vinegar Syndrome, including Play Dead, Hellmaster, which has a bonkers cover, and I don't know what it's going to be about, and Night Owl. And they also have the latest release from Scream Factory, including the amazing Universal Horror Box Set, Galaxy of Terror, Humanoids of the Deep, and The Entity. So for all your horror and cult cinema needs, head on over to www.diabolikdvd.com or find them on Facebook.
This episode is also brought to you by Fright Rags. Fright Rags is the number one source for horror t-shirts. With specially curated collections created by renowned horror artists, they offer the best art and the best quality anywhere. Brand new this week, Fright Rags is celebrating the 20th anniversary of the Blair Witch Project with 5 new shirts, a baseball tee, socks, and 2 enamel pins. Relive your childhood summers with their colorful retro-style shirts, popular reprints for Jaws and E.T. And our Shockwaves listeners can save 10% now at checkout by entering code WAVES10. Again, that's WAVES10. Save 10% off at checkout.
This episode is also brought to you by Vinegar Syndrome. Coming this month from one of America's top purveyors of sleaze, Vinegar Syndrome is Douglas Slutch's Michigan Lensed and John Saxon starring creature feature Hellmaster. Hits Blu-ray in a new cinematographer approved 4K restoration, which also presents the film in its never on home video original theatrical version. Peter Whiteman's Satanic Dog Sleeper Play Dead, starring Yvonne DiCarlo, also hits Blu-ray, freshly restored and featuring a first-time interview with its nearly 100-year-old director. Plus, 2 slices of smut in the form of Roger Last House on the Dead End Street, Watkins' The Pink Ladies, uncut for the first time since the early 80s, and Ron Sullivan's Mascara, which was produced, shot, and edited by New York queen of exploitation cinema, Roberta Finlay. Be sure to drop on by the Vinegar Syndrome table if you're planning to head to Indianapolis Day of the Dead, Crypticon Kansas City, Fantasia Genre Film Festival in Montreal, and also remember to check out vinegarsyndrome.com for sales, specials, and just about all of your exploitation cinema needs.
All right, we got our guest in the house, Mr. Gary Dauberman. You may, I at the top of the show, I was listing off a bunch of his credits, It and Annabelle series. And yeah, you were part of The Nun, correct?
Right. Yeah, I wrote that. Yeah.
You wrote The Nun, mm-hmm. La Llorona. You're basically like Juan's like go-to dude and New Line.
Yeah, for sure.
But back in my journalism days, there was a publicity company that did a really hard push for your very first film, Blood Monkey.
Ugh, yeah.
Which we cannot ignore. Gary, we cannot ignore this.
Embrace the past, the beginning.
Exactly. No, because I think, at the time I was running Shock Till You Drop, and I remember I forgot what the PR company was, but they were like, you need to check out Blood Monkey. And I was like, based on that title alone, yes.
That's not his first film, Rye. In the Spider's Web is his first film, which was a wonderful sci-fi classic.
Yeah, right? That's true. Yeah. Well, I agree too. It was my first film at the sci-fi class.
I got a thing for spider movies in general, but then you did Swamp Devil as well.
The Maneater series.
The Maneater series. Oh, wait. If it was the Maneater series, that wasn't sci-fi. Those were Genius products.
Yeah. Corrected.
Genius products.
Well, this was definitely, this was during the time when, you know, these DVD companies were packaging things with under like super brands. Like, it was like Dimension Extreme and the Maneater series. Anyways. I think it's, you know, in terms of the kind of Hollywood career, you're a great example of, you know, going down, doing cool, like kind of B movie projects and then rising through the ranks, man. I mean, like,
yeah, I really want to know what took you from Swamp Devil to Annabelle. Like, there's a good story there.
There isn't really. You know, doing those movies, you know, that was at a time where it's funny because I get asked about these movies almost as much as I get asked about like It.
Sure, of course.
I'm happy to talk about because I do think it's a good lesson for writers out there and filmmakers and stuff. And, you know, I was out here, you know, waiting tables, doing that whole thing. And Sci-Fi Channel used to put on those movies once a week. Mm-hmm. And they would say, we have a cast, we have a location, we have a title, we don't have a script, we shoot in 2 weeks. Can you take a weekend or take a couple of days and just bang something out?
And was it sci-fi or was it like that company UFO or Asylum? Was it somebody else that was kind of
I don't know.
Managing that process? Or?
Yeah, I don't know. Because
I remember
who was it? RHI.
Ah, okay, got it.
Way back.
Yep.
So, but they would come to you, so they would have all that stuff. So I'd have a couple days to be able to write a beginning, middle, and end.
Yeah.
And then they'd be off and shooting. And then I was able to quit, waiting tables and doing all that stuff and then just focus on the writing because it was back, I didn't need much to live, and to be able to get paid writing. Mm-hmm. Was a big thing for me. Yeah. And it was like, oh man, if I just can do one of these a year, that'd be fantastic. Cause all I wanted to do is get paid to write and then just write some more.
Yeah. Were you inclusive in the process once they did start shooting these movies? I mean, like they obviously had escalated production schedules.
They started to, and then I was like, I've never seen the movies. I've never, it was just, but it was like, to me,
you're not
going to
be
like,
precious about it.
Did they give you a formula going in? Was it like, it has to have a cold open or we have to feature this particular actor or,
Yeah, they had some of those things. There's some boxes that needed to be checked. And that was a good like, oh, how can I work with others? Mm-hmm. You know what I mean? And that it taught me that stuff. But it was really like I was involved for the 6 days I was writing the script, and then they were off and running, and I was back, and they would go, hey, we have another one we need to do. When can you do that?
Yeah.
So I was counting on that stuff to come by every couple months because then it was like the money was running out, and you needed all that.
Yeah.
It sort of sharpened my my pencil or something, but it made me learn how to write a little bit quicker, I think, than a lot of other people. I still will bang out pretty quickly, and then the rewrites take a little bit longer and stuff, but it's just like, let's just get it out there. It taught me not to be precious about that first draft because you need to get it done. And it taught me, I don't like writing scripts. I really like writing movies. Yeah. Like I want things to get made. So it's like, how do I work with other people and get people invested in and involved in the process as I'm writing and make it more of a conversation, make it more of a dialogue as opposed to like, okay, I'll see you guys in 12 weeks and I'll come back with something and maybe you'll like it. Maybe you won't.
Yeah.
And
these were obviously, kind of pillars that you took with you once you started doing things like Annabelle and It and the Nun.
Yeah, man,
so
I got
on.
No shame about it. I have friends who I would, I'm like, oh, I can't do that one, but I have other friends and I would say, hey, you should call this person up. And they would go, oh no, I'm a little above that. That's not, and by the way, unproduced, but they're just going like, no, I'm waiting for Raimi to call me. Yeah. And you're like, and they're still waiting for that phone call. It's like, work begets work.
Exactly.
You know what I mean?
Yeah. That's the most frustrating thing is when I talk to independent filmmakers and stuff like that. And they're like, I went in for this, this IP over at a major studio, and they pitched me this, a sequel. And I was like, nah, man. I was like, yeah, but you haven't done anything. Take that job.
It's going to be an education. It's not like, hit a couple doubles, triples and get that work out there and learn the process. It's such an education. It's such a, you know, and I love making stuff. So it's just, I love that process. I really that's what I enjoy. Yeah. Just working on stuff. So it's like, so it got me to really enjoy and I definitely learned a lot.
What did you want to write though then? So like when you get your first sci-fi kind of crack at saying, what in your brain were you going to be writing? Was it genre at that moment? Or was that the goal, or was it something left of that?
Yeah. No, it was always genre. Cool. I mean, I've always loved horror, sci-fi, you know. My first spec, which got me these gigs, was, you know, a ripoff of Big Trouble in Little China that, you know, I still one day want to make. But yeah, so it was all in my wheelhouse. It wasn't like, oh, I'll do this because I get a, you know, so I can do my biopic.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, nothing against biopic. It's just not, you know, I'm, you know, it's just, I don't have that passion right now.
Yeah.
So for me, it was, you know, oh my God, I can write full time. And, you know, so.
Where did you grow up?
Outside Philadelphia.
And in genre, you know, like obviously I'm sure the horror consumption was very much like our upbringing. Video stores, Fangoria, stuff like that.
Yes. Yeah. Yes. Suncoast Video.
Oh, hell yeah. I remember when they closed down and everything went 90%. I had so much crap from them.
Yeah. Suncoast Video, West Coast Video was the, well, Suncoast Video. Yeah. But West Coast Video was the rental.
Right.
Yeah. We had Suncoast. That's where you went for like all of your Addams Family merch.
Oh, that's right.
In the mall.
It was in the mall.
My Sega Master System games were there. Mm-hmm. Where'd you grow up then?
Winchester, Virginia. Just a little bit away from Philadelphia. Not too far down.
Yep. So yeah, that was my, and you know, I miss, you know, going into, I understood from very early on the business of horror as well, because it was always one of those places where you went into the store and there was always people in the aisle just picking up a box and going, I guess this looks cool. Yeah. Let's get this one. It wasn't really dependent on who was in it. Right. It's just, this sounds like a great concept and I want to, you know, so it's always made, but I, you know, going in and seeing the box art and all that stuff is just, you know, I really miss that. And, you know, it's a bummer that stuff's not around anymore, but
yeah, there was I think there was like a little bit more decision making back then. When you go to the video store, you're just like, okay, I want that.
As I think that's why we're sitting all sitting on the couch in this
room. And flipping through Netflix and being indecisive about stuff.
I spend way more time trying to figure out what to watch than watching things. And yeah, it was always, you know, and also a lot of times your decision was made for you, cause you're like, oh, that's all out.
Yeah.
50
yeah.
copies. Yeah. Or this is out, so I guess I'll go with this.
Now, I've mentioned on the show before that I don't know how people date anymore, because that's how I did it. Was you went to the video store and it was 20 minutes of meandering while you discussed movies. And if you picked up Terms of Endearment as opposed to like, I don't know, like some horror film, then that was going to be the second date right there. Like, okay, there we go.
Wow.
So what was
Terms of Endearment's pretty good, but just saying that. Yeah. It's got Jack. No. I mean,
it's not a date movie.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Rick, this isn't Drama Wave.
All right.
But it was like deep cuts. Like, I remember one of the very first dates I took to a video store, I remember he wanted to watch Time Bandits, and I was like, okay, we may talk.
Yeah, Time Bandits. That's third base.
Proceed.
Time Bandits is a third base kind of movie. Yeah. It's got Sean Connery, the knickers drop with Connery. So.
So what was the path to Annabelle? Was that the first one for you?
That was the first in the Conjuring universe.
In the Conjuring universe,
sure. I was New Line brought me in on a round table on when they were doing their remake of reboot of Nightmare on Elm Street.
Oh.
And they had some additional footage on that.
Mm-hmm.
Right. So I pitched out a couple ideas. They liked them, so I wrote those. And that's kind of what got me into the New Line family.
Take us inside that room. Yeah, very curious.
This is after the movie was already shot and they were trying to come up with new stuff for it, or what part of the process?
Oftentimes, you know, you just go, hey, what can we, you know, are the things we can improve and all
What else can Freddie do?
Yeah. But it was, you know, and it's, you know, I love those rooms because there's nothing more I like than sitting in a room with a bunch of other creative people or writers or and directors and just talking about story and how can we make this better? So that's, you know, that was the start of all that. And then they knew, I had seen a very, very early cut of The Conjuring, by the way, not that much different from how it is now.
Right.
But they knew I was such a fan of it instantly. And, knowing that's when they decided to do Annabelle, they're like, hey, why don't we go to, Gary?
Nice. Yeah, nice. Yeah. And did James already have an idea of what he wanted from an Annabelle film spinoff, or was it just found through creative discussion and meetings?
No, he kind of had broad strokes, and then we had our we got a little bit more granular with it for sure.
Yeah.
But that was, you know, another process that happened pretty quickly. Going back to the, you know, the Blood Monkey days. And then from there is just, you know, and then it just kind of, you know, it's, you know, you try to find the right material, but you also try to find the right people to work with too in this business, which is a lesson I've learned, you know, over the years, is trying to find the right partners. Cause man, it's a slog if you're working with people that you're just like, you know,
it's work,
and it makes it work. Yeah. Which is not what you want. Cause it really does affect your writing, your work, where it doesn't feel like a sense of, you know, I like to have some sense of playfulness or play, or just, you know, a little bit more of a relaxed atmosphere.
For sure.
And when you're working with friends and partners who have that too, who share those sensibilities, then it makes it a little bit easier. So we try to, you know, work as often as we can together.
That's cool. And in terms of mapping out that kind of Conjuring universe, how inclusive are you? Is it like kind of born from James's brain? Is it like a kind of mapping out a series, or is it less complicated than that? Is it kind of just film by film, figuring it out?
You know, I think it's less complicated. Yeah. I think James has his, you know, he has his ideas, and he certainly thinks ahead, but I think we try to focus on the movie that we're working on now, as opposed to, okay, how is this movie going to affect the second or third movie down the line? That's never really enters the conversation at all. It's just, how can we make this movie good? Because if this movie isn't good, we might not be able to do that second or
third
movie.
Yeah.
So, and that's, you know, a lot of people ask about, you're like, hey, we want to do this universe. And it's like, you know, just start with one and then build off that, I think, is the
Wanaverse.
The Wanaverse.
No.
Becca's trying to make this happen.
It's a Wanaverse. Thing now, the Wanaverse.
It is. But yeah, but you know, and I think to James, you know, he's super collaborative, and it's always a conversation. It's always, what about this? Or what if we tried that? And I think he's open to it. It's not being so rigid and going, no, this is what it has to be. Because it's the best idea wins, sort of thing.
Actually, I was just thinking, Becca, your Wanaverse actually has some, I think there's something there, because La Llorona is not part of the Conjuring universe, yet it's connected in some way by the priest from...
But Perez,
And then we've got the nun, and then we've got all the others. Those are a little more
linear. Aquaman's tied into Annabelle, and it's all one big happy
thing. So, all of the different ghosts in Annabelle, the new Annabelle. Yeah. I've got money on the bride being spun off into the next inclusion of the Wanaverse. Okay. He's going ferryman.
And I'm all in on the monkey with the clanking. because you don't explore it at all, but I love it.
Although I do have to say, the one I would most want to see is the werewolf. So
I know. That monkey is on my mantle at home.
See?
I love that monkey.
Monkey's going to speak to you in your dreams. No, with the script.
Yeah. I'm sorry, Rob. I cut you off.
I was going to ask, actually, because to me the linchpin, if you want to refer to it that way, but to me the one I'm most fascinated by is the second Annabelle, because it feels like. It feels like that one really made an effort to tie them all together. And more importantly, and I say this as a compliment, it kind of, what's that term when you retcon, it feels like it retcons almost all the movies in a way of what happened and what's going forward. So was that the intention with the second Annabelle? Is like, all right, how can we really make this all work?
But that wasn't the reason, you know, it was like, okay, what's the story here? And then I was like, well, what's the, you know, you got to think of like, what's the reason for being here? And I really do genuinely love that movie. I love working with Sandberg, taking Not to Other Park.
It has some of the best gags. We talked about it a lot last year. It's just in terms of visual directing gags.
Yeah.
And set up and payoff. That's
like,
really
the jump scares. Well,
going back to making it more of a prequel. You know, like, was that like, oh, there's, it'd be more interesting if we went back for this next
one. Yeah. Well, that was early on. You know, I knew I had the bookend of, okay, we're going to go back and this is how it's going to open. I knew where I wanted to get with it. Like once I knew I had that ending, I had that very, very early on, because I was like, well, what am I going to do here? And then that was one of the early first ideas I had of just that ending. Oh, we're going to end up at the first one. And then I kind of worked backwards from there. But yeah, that was just what was your question? Yeah. But we decided that very early on. But you know, we knew, and I wanted to explore the Dawn mythology a little bit and the creation of it. But I wanted to go a little bit beyond that, and James did, and all that, and we kind of that's where we landed. But yeah, super. I'm very, very happy with that.
A lot of horror, I mean, you're setting up a universe, but unlike a lot of horror films in general, especially modern horror films, I think they're emotional stories. So they're all really quite focused because of the afterlife, as tends to be about grief often. Mm-hmm. But I thought especially the second one, you know, setting mm-hmm. up this kind of like The Boy, I guess, you know, that movie, The Boy. But this idea of it's almost like Grief Dolls, you know, or something like that.
Right.
And there's a lot of emotion to all these films. Even the newest one, which is the one you just directed, it's super playful. And I think that's what I was responding to, that it isn't heavy, but yet as Ryan was pointing out, the person who has the grief story isn't even the lead character, and yet you really get invested in that, and that actually felt quite original.
I think that's
not a question, that's all just compliments couched in the
Elric,
phrasing
that guy
of a question.
You were that guy at the Sundance screening. It was like, I'm going to tell you why this works.
Yeah.
Excuse me, sir. What's your question?
No, I do that a lot.
Well, what was that? I'm very curious, because that does come from someplace, because generally, you know, you would figure the largest emotional arc is going to come from, you know, the Warren kid, you know, and it turns out to be the friend, you know, I'm forgetting her name, but my wife was crying at the end when she had that moment with Vera. Well, and it was like, okay, that is, she's the heart of this one.
That's very, yeah, I mean, a lot of times you're presented with a problem. You're going like, well, someone's got to open up this case.
Yeah.
You know, who's it going to be? It's not going to be Jude. You know, it's like, what is the reason? And then you kind of just, you go from there and try to figure out and solve that, you know, her backstory is a personal one to me. So it was just, it just felt, and I didn't want it to just be the dumb best friend who comes. I wanted to set her up like that.
Like first victim,
usually. You know what I mean? Yeah. You know what I mean?
That's what it felt like.
Of course she deserves what she, I wanted to set it up, but then sort of subvert that expectation.
Yeah, that was cool.
That was the hope. And the playfulness is something that I just, I wanted to have a little, you know, James calls it sort of a Monster Squad-esque type thing, which I take as a very high compliment. But I felt we hadn't done that before. It takes place in the Warren household, so in a house. Mm. So I can't have a high body count because you see in Conjuring 2.
Yeah.
You know, and it's Judy Warren. She's 10 years old. You have the babysitter and all that. It just felt to me, it just felt, I wanted sort of a lightness of tone but also make it scary. I was hoping, you know, even when it wasn't scary or we're trying to make it scary, it's still somewhat, it's still entertaining. Like, you're not going like, oh, let's just fucking, come on, let's get on with it. And so that was the hopes. And I think those, and I, you know, it's really, I give all the credit to the cast. I mean, cause they really carry some, carry a lot of scenes where it's just fucking me laying pipe, you know, exposition. God.
I loved all of the different scares that you set up. That, like, even the board, Mealy McFeely or Feely McNeely.
Feely Mealy, yeah.
Like, even
an actual game.
Is it?
Yeah, yeah.
That's an actual game.
Yeah. They're popular around that time. A lot of that's why, when I'm working on these movies, I was like, what was happening in that time? What were people playing with? You know, but yeah.
Wow. Okay. That was like Becca's terrifying.
Check out eBay.
I know. I'm like, I need a copy of Mealy McFeely.
She's going to just Google Feely Mealy. She's going to get the
Mealy,
worst response by Google. I was going to say, going into the director's chair, you know, I mean, at what stage did you know you were going to be in that position in the creation of this? How was the experience?
I wrote to direct this one. I knew it was one of those things early on. Yeah. It was just like, hey, do you want to do this?
Got it.
And, you know,
got
I was
it.
Like, yes. I'd been on a set for a lot of the other ones. I've been around some great directors and was able to soak up a lot of knowledge, a lot of, you know, just kind of secondhand experience. Yeah. So it just felt like, and being able to work within the family of, you know, I knew all the crew members. I have such a, you know, a lot of friendships with a lot of these people. It just felt like the right opportunity.
Yeah. Well, you were talking earlier about having that kind of insulation of working with people that made you feel like you were supported. So obviously now being in the director's chair and you know, having that playfulness with other, you know, your colleagues. I'm sure that was a good, great experience.
And that was one of those things. Yeah. Cause it's
like Judson and Mike Clear and, you know, those guys.
And they're friends, right? Yeah. So it doesn't feel like you get to go hang out and it doesn't ever feel like you're doing this on your own.
Yeah.
Like there's always someone there. If you gotta, like, I'm not, I'm not, you know, if I've got questions or if I don't know something, I'm going to say, I don't know. I'm not going to sit there and bullshit and just pretend. And I think that's, and you know, but unfortunately I have people that I trust that I can say that where I don't have to be like, oh, you know, oh my God. So, and so, so, you know, people like Justin Clear, James, you know, it's, you know, to be able to turn to him and ask him a question or text him or you know, do whatever. I mean, that's just, I mean, it doesn't get much better than that.
Did James impart any advice to you before you jumped into it? As a director?
It's not like, it was like sort of an ongoing dialogue. I mean, he wasn't like, it's not like here's 10 things you need to know.
Sure.
It was just like when I had questions, I would ask him, you know, I think, you know, he said to me early on, he's like, I know you've been holding out on me. Don't let me. you know, but so he's like, don't do that. But it was just, he's so supportive and he's so generous with his, it's like a magician showing you how his trick is done. Mm. It is what it feels like, you know, where it's just like, this is, and you know, and he was like, why are you giving this away for free? you know, but yeah, it was just, like I said, it was just an ongoing, you know, through prep, production, and then in post. I mean, some of my favorite moments is, you know, in the process is being in the edit room with him and Kirk and, you know, Moore, who's edited a lot of James's movies and did this one. Yeah. You know, it's midnight, we're eating fried chicken and we're going, let's try this, you know? And so it was a great experience.
Do any of the ideas or the antiques and the various things that are in the Warren's lab basement or whatever you want to call it, do any of them come from reality of things that were actually in the Warren's lockup or stories that they actually encountered? Like, is there any connection, not so much truth, not looking for it to be based on a real story, but do any of the ideas ever come generated from that reality?
Yeah, I mean, I always go back to their case files because I always find there's some kernel or something I miss that maybe is inspiring. The werewolf is one of their more famous cases. Yeah. You know, they a man was possessed by the spirit of a werewolf, and that was outside of Essex. So that's one that we kind of were like, oh man, wouldn't it be cool to do that and sort of just introduce that element in this and. So that's what we did. So that was, but the actual artifacts, like the objects themselves, there are some, but not, you know, like the ferryman coins or, you know, things like that. Mm-hmm. Yeah. It's like
no samurai suits it's a mix. In there.
I don't think there's a samurai.
Did you ever step foot in it? The real?
No.
I know Joe Bishar did, right?
And James
Joe Bishar wanted to sleep in that room. And I'm like, you're nuts, man.
That is so Joe Bishar. I love it.
He's the
I don't think they would let him. Or something.
Yeah. And he, by the way, you know, that guy's such a VI, you know, he's such a MVP of this movie. Like I love all his work. Like he does such a great job. But even, on set, he would come. He's like, hey, I'm going to, so after everybody leaves, I'm going to hang out here for a couple hours. And it's like midnight, 1 a.m. And he's like, just get a vibe of the place. I'm like, all right, dude, that sounds
like him, all right.
Yeah.
Oh my gosh.
But then he'd come back with like, hey, this is what I thought of last night. It's again, to be a part of his process, because I've been a fan of his and a friend of his for a long time, but haven't worked with him that direct, like going over to his house and listening to stuff and, you know, going back and forth on things. I hadn't done that. And that was pretty much the back and forth was like, what do you think of this? And I'm going, this is great.
Yeah.
Keep going. You know, it's not much too many notes there, anything like that. The guy's a treasure, man.
Mm. Yeah.
Go ahead.
I was just gonna ask you. So actually this came up in a conversation with a friend earlier today. So the ending of the first Conjuring teases Amityville Horror, and then the opening of Conjuring 2 is post Amityville Horror. Is there any reason in particular that maybe that particular case hasn't been covered? Like basically I want to see the Warrens go to Amityville. Or is it just the fact that there's like 8 million Amityville movies, like ripoff movies at this point? Like, has that ever come up? Like actually doing the Amityville story?
That's a question for James. It hasn't ever, for me, ever come up. I mean, you know, I don't know the answer to that, to be honest with you. Yeah. Okay. I don't know. I wish I had something more satisfying for you. I think it'd be super cool for sure.
Yeah. Well, especially when you have people like Vera and, you know, it's like, I'd love to see them in that version of that movie. Rather than these multiple other Emmys.
No, yeah.
I Except for part two, which is kick ass.
Yeah.
Amityville 2.
The one about time is pretty good, guys.
The Conjuring universe has way less incest than Amityville 2 has. And that's one of my gripes. I'm not going to lie.
I want to back up because we haven't talked about
it. Well, it could be a rights issue, too.
Yeah, maybe.
You know what I mean? I don't know.
I don't know. I feel like everyone's done an Amityville.
Yeah, it's pretty open.
It's kind of saturated.
I know. I don't know, though.
I want to back up and talk about it because we were talking about at the top of the show about some of the like our favorite remakes of the past 8 years. And I have to say, like, it is...
I wouldn't call it a remake, though. Yeah. Personally,
you would call it a reimagining of the.
It's a movie version of the book. Yeah. So, the original is a TV movie adaptation.
So yeah, I want to kind of start at the beginning.
She's about
of that.
To say something nice, yeah. And you get
sorry.
It's okay. This happens a lot. Anyway, I kind of want to start at the beginning of that at like, how did you approach the material? Like, how did you go back to the source material and then kind of figure out your own course with it?
Yeah, you know, that book is something that I've carried with me for, very long. You know, it got me out of Christopher Pike and L.R. Stein and all those guys I care very deeply about that story. And, you know, it's me playing editor of what can I do and talking with Andy and like, okay, we know we want to include this stuff. What do we have to lose in order to do that? Because the movie can only be so long and you want it to, you want that engine there. So it feels like there's some propulsion and it's going towards something. And, you know, the book has all these great little tangents and all that stuff. And you just can't. So it's really kind of like, okay, well, what we got to distill it down to the story we're trying to tell in the movie.
Did you always know it would be two? Like, what was your starting point with Andy? Because there'd been multiple iterations before you guys.
Right.
Were you able to just not look at that at all and just start from scratch with Andy?
Yeah, we kind of, I mean, so the studio decided to make it two movies pretty early on. Right. So we came on board once that decision was already made. And then, it certainly freed us up because that was, that would be a daunting task to do all that. And then it was Andy and I, again, we didn't really look too much at past drafts. We really just went back to the book, because that's what we fell in love with. And how do we not, I'm not going to ever outright Stephen King or outthink him. It's the guys, it's just trying to go, okay, well, how can we make this into a movie? How can we take these scenes and make them, how are we going to approach it in a cinematic fashion? Mm-hmm. So it's kind of, I go back and, I'm doing that with the same thing with Sam's Lot now. Mm-hmm. It's just trying to go back. Okay, what distill it down. You just kind of do an outline based off the book and go, I want this scene. I want that scene. I want this and this character. And unfortunately, can't use that character. And that's kind of the process.
I didn't know you were doing Sam's Lot now. I'm really excited. I love Sam's Lot. I love those creatures.
Gary loves tackling the giant Stephen King books.
Well, a lot of the heavy lifting is done for you. I mean, it's the book is, that's another book that is just,
That's why it's a miniseries, I guess, at one point.
Yeah,
two.
But what was any of your creation a reaction to the miniseries, like the original It miniseries, like things that you felt, that they went that direction or it's that kind of tone? Let's try to push a different, because it feels really different tonally, I think.
Yeah, but no, I didn't go back. I purposely stayed away from the miniseries because I don't want to approach something and go, oh, we can do, this didn't work for them. Let's do it this much better. I don't think that's like a healthy place to start from. Mm. It's like, I just want to start from a more pure place and that's the book. Same with Salem's Lot. Like I haven't gone back and watched, I love the David Soul stuff, but I just haven't gone back and revisited because it's just, I don't want to be influenced by that.
You're telling me you're not going back to Rob Lover's. Come on.
I bought that to revisit. I haven't seen it.
I don't know if I've seen that one, to be honest with you.
I have never seen that one.
Well, did you guys land fairly early on with it? The idea of the first movie just being the kids and then the second movie being adults, because the beautiful thing about that miniseries, because it was for TV, is it's one of the most perfect seven act like setups. There's seven characters, commercial break, etc. But was it kind of an early decision, like, all right, we can be more successful if we do it?
That was before me.
This was
before me. Yeah. So they already wanted to make two movies and it was going to be kids and then it was going to be adults.
Oh wow!
Yeah, and but that was kind of the only thing we took, and then So then, but it, like I said, it freed us up to just focus on and not have to worry about like what we got to cut out of and go back to the adult. Yeah. I think it also brings an immediacy to the scares and to the characters too, without it feeling like just one giant flashback or this is what happened. And you cut back to them sort of, you know, so I think that helped a great deal.
And you can build a lot of empathy with children. I think that's part of it. You get to spend a whole movie with just children. And I think that's a really – I think the popularity of things like Stranger Things just shows how that works, you know?
Oh,
before we get now to meet them as adults, will just be a whole new experience. I'm very interested in how that's going to feel, you know? It'll be cool.
It feels great. I've seen it.
I've seen it.
I was going to say it was
– I didn't see the trailer until before your movie. I kept virginal of the trailer.
Well, we're recording this a week out from Comic-Con. Are you going down to Comic-Con for their big horror New Line Night thing?
Yeah. Yeah. But I go Comic-Con every year because I'm just
You're just a nerd too.
Well, that's great.
Go ahead.
Oh, I was just gonna say. I mean, like when Bill Skarsgård was brought in as Pennywise, how did that affect finding that tone of Pennywise? I mean, obviously you had already set it down on page, but did you make any alterations based on any hang sessions with him in terms of finding the personality or building out Pennywise in any way that you had not initially found?
You know, I think Andy and Bill had some of those sessions. It was talking to him. You know, he would have some ideas. There was a lot of sort of, oftentimes you go, you know, what sounds right in your head, sort of dialogue wise, you're going, oh, that sounds like that's a mouthful.
Yeah.
Let me try to do something a little bit easier on this.
Right,
you know.
Right.
So there are things like that, but it didn't go. Suddenly we were going in one direction and then he was cast and we're like, no, now it's got to go in this direction. It wasn't, he was cast because he was also going in the same direction we were, you know, but Andy's so, so talented, but you know, and that cast is as well of that first, those kids are amazing in the way they can bounce off each other and all that. And, you know, it's just, again, it's when it's not being scary, you still feel like, you know, it's still a very, very entertaining movie, I think.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, for sure. It was one of those movies that, you know, when you go in, Elric always talks about chasing the dragon, finding that movie experience that you feel like you're like a kid again. And I, you know, stepping out of it, which was a great experience, I was like, okay, I want to go see that. I want to go back and re-enter that world this weekend. And
what was the last movie that did that for you?
Ooh, that's a good question. That probably shook me in a way. It's probably something in this. Oh, well, it was probably when I actually do know when it was. It was when I caught up to having stepped away from horror, getting bored in the like late 90s. And then it was seeing House of the Devil and The Descent really close together. So it wasn't like one of them, is seeing both of these two movies that felt totally fresh and reminded me of what I loved about horror films.
Right.
So it was like, cause I just must have seen them on disc straight away. And then it was kind of this trend of some of these A24 type movies, then mixed with things like The Conjuring, like seeing what horror could, this broad spectrum of what horror can still be, whereas I felt that broad spectrum was missing from the late 90s. Like it was much more like focused teen thing that at a certain point I just wasn't necessary for me. And so sometimes that's all it takes, a little quick sharp shock, and you're like, oh wow, they're making a movie with a babysitter walking around a house and there's a Satanist in the
right, thing.
And it was really cool, you know.
Yeah.
And sometimes it's just a singular voice, you know, one filmmaker, it couldn't be enough, you know.
I mean, this late night, it felt like, you know, for a long time, just having been in it felt like everybody was using horror as a stepping stone.
Yeah.
Like, I I'll do this so I can go do that. Mm-hmm. And I think then something clicked or something happened. I don't know what. I think people like James. But really elevated the genre and made it feel like, dude, this is, you're not slumming it because you're doing horror. It's not, you know, and I think, and the people you mentioned too. I mean, you know, it's, I remember, seeing The Descent, like that was, just being blown away. Like that was, you're right. That's one that reinvigorated my love of the genre too. Cause for a while there, you're just like,
The funniest thing is I hadn't heard of it because I was living in New Zealand, hadn't even heard of the title, and it popped up in Film Comment. So like for here I am, like usually I find my horror stuff somewhere else. I was reading this, like I think it was Laura Kern, and she's writing this high end thing about woman and representation of blood, and you got the woman cover, and I was like, what the hell is this movie she's talking about? So when I finally got it, I was like, holy shit, it's a badass horror film. So it was kind of cool that it was already crossing a boundary into, you know, high culture, whatever the fuck that. Yeah.
Right.
So anyway.
Right.
I'm curious, what's yours?
I don't know. I really don't. I The man, come back to me on that.
Quizzes are hard. Well, I guess the flip side of it is kind of like what I was going through. Was there a period where you did find yourself less interested in the kind of trends in horror? Like, I guess for me, it was like that post, even though I Know What You Did Last Summer, it's perfectly fun. But there was something about these movies coming out one after time that at a certain point, I'm just like, it's not for me that they're creating these movies. You know, I just kind of aged out of it or something. Was there a period for you that you're just less interested in what was happening in the genre?
Yeah, I mean, I think for me, it was like the late 90s, early, like, I don't know, they felt a little bit disposable. Mm. You know, I think, like, I love Scream, as you said, I Know What You Did Last Summer, I love, but then it just became a little bit, you know, and they're doing it now, I guess, you know, but it just feels like you're mimicking one that came before, and they all become sort
of saturation point.
Yeah, they come out like a little bit interchangeable, where it's just, you kind of just, you know, looking for something that's new and fresh.
They're more fun now. Like, if I watch them now, I can have a good time with them because there's nothing at stake. But they're saying about being that
when
age.
When they were coming out.
Yeah, it's just the pattern of them at a certain point.
See, but the late 90s for me was when I was – that was like a beautiful time of horror for me because it was Deep Rising and Event Horizon and and Mimic and The Relic.
The Mummy.
And actually, not The Mummy.
I know.
It was cool. But yeah, but those films –
always something.
They were something. Like Placid. I mean, those were ones that were completely reigniting me.
Well, it was like Pitch Black.
Yeah. Oh my God.
Like Pitch Black.
I do love Pitch Black.
Yeah. Pitch Black snuck out through the midst of like between Urban Legend and Valentine. It was like suddenly, who the fuck is Vin Diesel and what's this great monster movie that's coming out of nowhere? You know?
Yeah. And that is a movie you reference quite a bit because I do love that movie. But it's not as if, it was just, you know, yes, there are some gems in, you know, whatever, but
it's also more about us. It's not really condemning that period. It's usually about what are you doing in that period, and we all have those periods as filmgoers, you know, where we need some other inspiration. That's why movies are endlessly interesting because you just have to change the lane when you get bored, right, and do something different. But that's actually, I mean, coming to your movie, I actually think that's why it works, because I think having a playful quality to also Vera and Patrick's character, because even the start is playful with them, I think that's super fun. I think that's a super fresh way to show them, because in James's world, even though they're fun and playful humans, you know, singing Elvis and stuff, they're very serious worlds and that's why the horror works so well in them. But I actually think this, of all the films so far, I think this is the most fun. And it's like, it's packaged to be exactly what it is, this big spook show. And I think people, I don't know if people are talking about that much. I don't know what the temperature on the film is, because it's been out, 2 weeks?
Yeah.
Sam, I avoid a lot of that stuff. But for me,
you and me both.
Yeah, it's probably smart. But it's like, I think sometimes you do want to just go back to a fun babysitter romp, you know?
Yeah, no. And that's, again, it was, you know, I've talked about this before, but I had spent months in Romania, you know, and I love, you know, Romania is great, and it's you're in Transylvania with Corin Hardy and all that stuff. But I got very, very homesick. I wanted a little bit of a comfort food sort of vibe. I just wanted to have some sense of and with the parents, with Ed and Lorraine, I wanted to see them as just kind of parents. Yeah. Like, they're on the way home and they're talking about Judy and what are we going to do, and just kind of be normal, because it was, you know, it's with this movie, I thought a lot about just what it was like. And I talked a lot about with the actual Judy about this. What was like having these people as your parents, and you probably wanting as a kid a normal life, and they do anything that's, you know, that's normal. But I wanted to normalize, you know, Ed and Lorraine a little bit, just to see what that relationship was like, because, you know, they're also a married couple and they have married, you know, I didn't want them bickering, you know, because what I love about the Warrens too is they have such a strong foundation.
Yeah.
Which I think is also makes it feel fresh. Yeah. It's not like, oh, there's cracks in the family and they're divided and, you know, and all that, because we've seen that 100 times.
Yeah.
Did you fall in love with any? I mean, you obviously fall in love with all the characters, but in this one, was there a chance that you were thinking any of these characters would spawn other movies? Not so much franchises in the way that the antiques and whatnot would, but like the actual characters, like the babysitter and her friend.
No, I don't think that far down the road. I do think there's more stories about Judy Warren. I do think that's interesting, about what path is she going to choose? Is she, you know, by the end of the movie, I think she's starting to embrace what her parents do, and also the gifts that she has. But I think there's more of that story to tell.
Right.
I think that would be cool. Right. But I just don't want to, you know, it's you want to kind of want these, the next movies to feel sort of organic to the, and not feel like, this is why I put this in here, because I think this is going to be a cool movie.
I'm thinking so, I'm just thinking. First sleepover party. Writes itself.
And I have to say, I love seeing...
Great idea.
Excuse me. I love seeing Madison Iceman. Iceland. Mm-hmm. She was the lead in Dave Parker's Sweet Tooth from Tales of Halloween. And so it was so cool.
Which one was she?
She was like the babysitter.
Oh, yeah.
So like, as soon as she popped up on screen, I was like, oh, Sweet Tooth. Yeah, it was like great seeing her.
Well, you know, and that, again, this cast, they're all fans of the genre. Maddie would show us films she made when she was 12 and 13, horror movies, like, cool. You know, like Babysitter Murders and stuff. And you're going like, Jesus, this is, I wish fun. I had friends at that age to make those movies. But it's, you know, there was a great shorthand there. They already got the genre because they were all fans of it. So that was a big, big help. But yeah, she is, they're all really, obviously talented, but also really delightful to work with.
All right. Well, you had mentioned earlier that you had seen it chapter two. Without spoiling anything, without saying anything, what word would you use to describe this in comparison to the first one?
I'm not going to compare it to the first. I'll just say if you really like the first one, you're really going to like the second one. Yeah. You know what? That's all I'm going to say.
Okay, fair enough.
Well, let me ask you this though. For the fun thing about it was fun revisiting the first one. After the second one was cast, because of course, when you watch the first one, you're thinking like, "Oh, who would be the adult version?"
Yeah.
Like, and then once you found out, like, then I went back and rewatched it. I was like, it's going to be Bill Hader. Like, you know, like seeing it. So was that fun for you as the writer getting to see the adult versions cast? Because you wrote it, you know them from the book, and now it's all these fairly well-known name actors.
Oh my! I mean, it's like who's playing Bill? Wait, who's playing Richie? I mean, it's amazing. And then being able to, you know, Andy is very inviting into the process. You know, we would see people who read for things. You know, it was a really exciting time to see who was and it was, you know, I think we often say we want volunteers, not recruits too. It's everybody really wanted to be a part of it as opposed to just like, please, can you just, you know, obviously working, you know, people wanted to work with Andy as well. So it's just, you know, that helped out.
That's cool.
Do you rewrite at all once you know who's cast? Like if it would have to help even slightly just based on their work?
You know, most often, you know, with, you know, like someone like Bill Hader, you just want to be like, just, you know, say something funny here.
Right. You know what they can do.
King, I'm not going to out funny him. Yeah, so it's like, just, you know,
but what's funny is
I would give him an idea, but
then you see him in something like Barry and you're like, oh my God, like I always think of Bill Hader as a funny guy. And then you see exactly what he's capable of because Barry's pretty dark.
It's really dark, I've always had an affinity for comedians who then go into sort of drama, the darker stuff. Yeah. I just think that
I feel like they all do because they are. I think that's what
they're
comedy
darker.
Is. Like,
I think, there's a lot of dark personalities in comedy. But man, I've always loved that. So I'm excited he's doing it because, that show's fantastic. Yeah. Yeah.
Have you ever interacted with Stephen King or heard from him regarding
I've heard, you know, his opinions on things, you know, just that he likes it and stuff. I haven't had direct interaction with him. I have a draft of an email, an email in my sort of saved file, and I'm just so nervous to send it. I don't know. Because you go into it, right? When you talk to these, sometimes when you meet your hero, he's like, well, how can I stand out from everybody else who said you've changed my life and you have such a great influence, but you're just going to be, and I was like, am I just going to be white noise to him? And I was just like, then you're like, I don't want to bother him because I also don't want him to feel like, oh, now I got to sit here and write a reply. You know what I mean? I'm like, I'd much rather him be writing a book, you know? I think about that, but, no, I haven't. But you know, I will. I'm going to go. My wife's from Portland, Maine, and I'll go up to Bangor this summer and just honk the horn as I'm going. just wave, you know, and that'll be it. But I hope one day to just be able to shake his hand and say thank you
and send that email.
Send that
email, man.
It'll be after a few drinks, and I'll be like, ah, fuck it.
See in the subject header, I'll be like, Stephen Bing. And you're like, fuck! God damn it.
Now, did I also see, are you afraid of the dark on your...
Yes, I was attached to that for a time, and then they're making that into a, they decided to go to a to
television
make it a mini-series
thing.
Which I'm not a part of.
Okay.
But I, it's another, you know, again, when people my age were out at parties, I was at home watching SNCC.
I watched so much of that show.
Yeah,
the girl who turned into the doll with the hands.
Oh, it
still fucked me up. Yeah. Like, still, I think back and I'm like, oh my God, I can't watch the episode. The hands. The hands.
I had that in my script. But it's been great revisiting those. You know, I have kids now and watching those, and they totally hold up, man. I mean, the kids totally, and I still enjoy it. It's great.
That's cool. Well, yeah. Gary, it sounds like you're going to be in the genre for a little while. I mean, like, obviously, the love runs deep. We're not going to lose you to any dramas or comedies anytime soon, I hope.
No. This is, I love this. I love the genre. I mean, this is, it doesn't, it's, I'm not.
Horror is not a stepping stone.
Stay here. We're good people.
No, I love it. No, I really do. I absolutely love it. I love the community.
Yeah.
That's
great. We're looking forward to Ed Chapter 2. We're looking forward to Salem's Lot and everything else you do, man.
Thanks for coming on. Thanks so much for having me. I really appreciate it.
Yeah, of course.